only at Viscount in Shelby Township on Van Dyke, just south of 23 Mile Road. Call Viscount at 1-877-FUN-ASAP. For great times right at home, it's Viscount.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and thank you for joining me. Man, it's been 2 weeks. We haven't broadcast this show since June 18th. And tonight, Night Call is brought to you by the Waking Up Store in the Universal Mall, 12 Mile and DeQuinder. Brand new sponsor. I was just out there talking to Mike Kitchen, the proprietor. And this is a hell of a place. We've got a commercial coming up, and that'll give you all the details. Well, welcome back. A number of people have written me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And if you are already dialing 313-298-WRIF, please have a little patience and either Jay or Norma will get to you. I rarely do this. I don't like to be the guy that sends people out for coffee and stuff like that, but, getting in my voice, so I had to ask someone to do it. Usually I do it myself. Well, I've been off on vacation, and it occurred to me, if you have a certain amount of privilege in this society, which I do, by virtue of my social class, which isn't real high, like middle class, right? But in this country, it's with such a divergence of wealth, and the fact that middle class is dropping in wealth. Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Peter.
Jay. Oh man. So now I won't sound like the Godfather. I always, you know, I think, how did the Godfather start sounding like the Godfather? You know, is he aged? So I got to start doing that. You know, I'm going to ask you a favor. Anyway, let me see. What? Oh man, what if I can't get out of this? I'm going to have to hold on here. There you go. Hey, all right, we're back. So, anyways, what was I saying? Anyway, someone keeps correcting me on that. Anyway, so by virtue of class privilege, race privilege, I'm a Euro-American, if you haven't guessed that, and gender privilege, I can do certain things and go certain places that other people in this country can't, and certainly people in the rest of the world can't. Because we got billions and billions of poor people, which we may talk some later. So I went off on this vacation. I went to a very isolated spot, which I don't want to identify, which people that are there most of the time year-round, and a lot of the people that go there don't want it identified either because they don't want anybody else going there. There's too many people there as it is. My family's been going there for about 45 years. Anyway, there's about very little is cell phone usage. It just there's this little tip of the place you can get it in. Very little, when this is just relatively new, email availability. So I was pretty much cut off. Used to be that a paper would come every 2 days. Now it's just maybe a day late, sometimes even the same day. So I found that I could just pretty much ignore everything we talk about. The war in Iraq, the shredding of our civil liberties, the way that the economy is working for the wealthy, but not for the rest of us. Well, maybe it is working for me. I don't know. Certainly, I haven't been taking the kind of hits that so many people have. I haven't been laid off. I haven't seen my benefits disappear. I haven't seen my the pension that I may or may not have go away just when I was expecting to retire, as so many other people have. So you can just kind of ignore all the problems of this country. And it takes sort of a special effort because other than, I don't know, even maybe just a third of the population, most of us know that what we're seeing on mainstream corporate media is a bunch of hooey, or that sometimes it gives you information that's not available elsewhere. You see a lot of visuals that you wouldn't. I rarely, as we've talked about in the past, I rarely bother to watch television. I don't find it very valuable at all. In fact, I don't know, this week, I watched the Wimbledon finals and I watched the World Cup finals. That's what it's good for. Mindless entertainment. And I like that. It's good to be mindless part of the time. That's what I did on vacation. I became very mindless about the problems of the world. Now, if you don't have that kind of privilege that I just indicated before that I have access to, what was that guy that's given all his money to the Gates Foundation? Why can't I think of his name right now? Anyway, He talked about, he had this great phrase. What was his phrase about sort of the luck of the draw, or what do you call it? Sperm, luck, or just where you wind up born. So I wound up lucky. A lot of other people haven't. In fact, the vast majority of the people in the world have not, been born lucky. They live a life of travail, of disease, of hardship, of urban crowding and pollution and crime. And there's a relatively few of us in the world that enjoy privilege, And there's enough here for everybody, but it's been hogged. It's been wealth in this world, although everyone adds to it. It's been redistributed once it's accumulated in an extraordinarily unfair way. Yeah, I wasn't even going to talk about this. Let me see if I can find what I was looking for real quickly. Now, I don't know. It makes it a little harder if I don't have this in front of me. Damn. Oh, yeah, here. Right in front of me here. By the way, if you want to call now, 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-WRIF. And this is from when I was on vacation, June 21st. The Republican-controlled Senate smothered a proposed increase in the minimum wage Wednesday, rejecting Democratic claims that it was past time to boost the $5.15 hourly pay floor that has been in effect for nearly a decade. So the Republicans, these representatives of the ultra-wealthy, decided that the poorest among us didn't need a raise. They, the senators, have given themselves raises of about $30,000 in the last few years. Of course, we're paying them generously. If you make $5.15 an hour, and there's not like hundred million people making that, but there's millions of people make that, and that winds up about $10,700 a year, and almost $6,000 below the poverty level for a family of three. That's what the government says. You can live on $16,700 a year. If you have a family of three, which, of course, is nuts. So it's nuts that we have a minimum wage that low. It's disgraceful. And it's disgraceful that these ultra-wealthy senators are going to deny the poorest among us a pitiful raise. I can't remember what it was, but it wasn't. Oh, yeah, here's it would raise to $5.85. Hey, that's 70 cents is, I suppose if you make that little, 70 cents more is a lot. $6.55 1 year later, and 7.25 a year after that. Inflation itself has eroded the value of the current minimum wage by 20%. So they're really making about $4 an hour. And the Republicans say, you don't need that. The poor don't need that, because one of the things they float, right, is that then prices will go up. I mean, that's absolute nonsense. Here's what the rich are doing. Ronald S. Lauder of the Lauder Cosmetics firm, he just bought a 1907 portrait by Gustav Klimt for his new gallery in Manhattan. He paid $135 million for this painting. For painting. Klimt, he's a guy who does good work, did good work. He painted it in 1907. This is the highest sum ever paid for a painting. And it's kind of extraordinary that, I don't know. There's a lot been written about what drives up the price of things that don't have intrinsic value. It's obviously supply and demand. But $137 million. So, and Lauder may be a Democrat. I don't know. Somehow it strikes me in the back of my mind that he is. But that much money accrues to the wealthy in this country so they can make this obscene purchase where other people are making $5.15 an hour. Let's see. Oh, yeah, across the world, and I won't read you all of this, but this is from June 16th, Reuters account. Forgotten urban poor, a living time bomb, according to the United Nations. The growing number of poor slum dwellers, the ticking time bomb that governments dare not ignore, according to the United Nations. The world will pass a critical point in 2007 when the majority of its 6 billion people will be urbanized, the world body said, and the majority of those in slums. And you probably remember, I've mentioned before, the essay by Mike Davis called A Planet of Slums. Very, very frightening essay. One I would highly recommend to get an understanding of what happens when a world is put together in the manner that this one is. It's, as I said, frightening. Here, this as well. Eking out a living of sorts from a mountain of muck in Manila. Some people in her old village look down on Teresa Yanoras, who traveled to Manila 30 years ago to find a better life and has earned her living digging through garbage ever since. Ms. Yanoras says it's, they say it's smelly, but she supports a family of five as a scavenger. They say we've come all the way here to Manila just to work in garbage. She works deep in garbage for 11 hours, and on her best days, she can earn a bit more than $3. If I get lucky one day, we eat well, but sometimes we have to make do with just fish paste and rice. A sparrow-thin woman, do you think, who has lost most of her teeth? She's one of 150,000 people who scavenge or recycle the 6,700 tons of garbage produced each day in Manila. This is repeated all around the world. Mexico City, where people live in garbage dumps. Let me take a drink of this hot tea. Wow. All right. And this is what drives people, for instance, in the case of Mexico, into the United States. Because the most, what would you say, the most, not adventurous, what's the word, the most energetic, but there's another word I want. The people that don't want to pick through garbage for a living, don't want to, once their livelihood, for instance, as farmers, is ruined by NAFTA, they say, we're going to come here to the United States and work. That's why people are here, because of the divergence in wages. Well, all right, 313-298-WRIF. Here, I would like to stand corrected on something. I said a few weeks ago when we were talking about this proposed flag desecration amendment, remember that? It lost by one vote in the Senate, that somehow, when this our Constitution, this foundation political document that talks about how the government should be administered and how what rights we have as citizens, suddenly is going to take up an issue that people find offensive. I would say that probably flag desecration, although I don't know. I mean, wearing bikini bottoms, is that? What else? I saw a whole bunch of things. I was thinking, man. Is that desecration? No, I don't think. I think people want to wear flags because they, I don't know, patriotic or just a fashion statement or what. But the idea that in our Constitution we would put something that we don't like is pretty weird. And I would include the idea that same-sex marriage would be prohibited by the Constitution in the same manner. Now, I said, though, there is particularly. There's an issue going with same-sex marriage. There's no issue about flag burning, and I said no flags are being burned in this country. Nothing's broken, and so why fix it? Well, obviously the Republicans are bringing it up as an election year diversion from the real problems, the mess they've made in almost everything, from the war and economy and all of that. I don't think it worked for them. I don't think it worked for him at all. But I did say that I didn't think any flags were being burned at all. So I stand corrected here. This is, I got this from a Santa Cruz Sentinel newspaper. Flags burn in celebration. About 25 revelers celebrated their freedom of speech and welcomed the 4th of July on Monday night with the, quote, second annual old-time American flag burn. Around a burn barrel at Seabright State Beach, organizer Brent Adams, 41, of Santa Cruz, declared flag burning not a protest but a celebration of the Constitution's First Amendment. Added fellow organizer Shah Lar, 32, seemed like a good idea to burn some flag just because we can. He's from Santa Cruz as well. The festivities were especially relevant after a constitutional amendment allowing Congress to ban flag desecration died in the Senate. That proposal came in response to Supreme Court rulings in 1989 and 90, pardon me, that burning and other desecrations of the flag are protected as speech by the First Amendment. So we had this deal where the laws against it were reviewed by the highest judicial body in the country, and they decided that burning flags was, in fact, political speech and had to be protected, no matter how odious the overwhelming majority of us think it is, no matter how mad it gets us, no matter how sad it gets us. The Constitution is not there to protect people from not being mad or not being sad. That's not its function. Now, the American Legion, which represents veterans, very poorly frequently, and in this case very poorly, has spent millions of dollars in lobbying congressional representatives and state legislatures to get a constitutional amendment that would abolish flag desecration. In the meantime, they're taking the money of their members, I guess it's up to them, where it could be used on in any number of benefits for vets, could be used to lobby the Bush administration who cuts back veterans' benefits, or something that would benefit veterans in the miserable conditions in the vet hospitals. But they're spending millions of dollars because it pisses them off that people burn flags, and usually people don't. So this is just a little psychotic as far as I'm concerned. Now, let's see. Not everybody on the beach in Santa Cruz appreciated the stars and stripes melting over the fire. Of course, they're plastic, right? So they don't burn, they melt. Bill Crawford, 16, of Aptos, which is just down the road from Santa Cruz, said, "I think they should keep it to themselves," whatever that means. He was on the beach with buddies, Elijah Manchester and Jacob Kendall, both 16 from Santa Cruz. Now, here's what Manchester said. "To me, this is what represents our nation and what represents our freedom, the flag." Okay, let's grant that, whatever. But he questioned why the group would want to burn the symbol of free speech. Why would the group want to burn the symbol of free speech? So, that's the deal. People are getting jerked around by a symbol. And this is not the way to go about political life. Symbols have the capacity to manipulate people's thinking very greatly. It's done all the time. And I would say almost always negatively. Yeah, almost always negatively. You can pull something positive out of that. But I was at a flag burning once where men were burning flags, putting them in a burn barrel and setting them ablaze. Oh, wait a minute, Pete. I thought you said people didn't burn flags. Well, this was a group called the American Legion. Wait a minute, you're saying the American Legion wouldn't burn flags? They're the guys that have spent millions of dollars of their members' money to stop this. Well, what do you do when your flag gets all raggedy? When it gets soiled? When it just gets plain worn out? Well, most countries, 99% of all countries in the world, they throw them out. But this country has an extraordinary number of rules about its flag. About it's got to be illuminated at night or brought down or, you know, all this stuff, like how it's folded. I never understood all that, but whatever. I mean, I don't think too many people are into that. Boy Scouts, ex-military guys, all that. But in any event, maybe some Canadian listeners can tell me. I don't think there's any rules about what you do with the Canadian flag. And I don't think too many people burn the Canadian flag. It's done when it is done as a political protest, a symbolic protest against the symbol of the American government. So it is political speech. It's a stupid act, because if you're trying to convince anybody, 99% of your audience is going to hate you. So it's dumb to do. And, back to the American Legion burning the flag. That's how you get rid of what they call out-of-service flags. Out-of-service flags mean they're not in service. So you take these flags and you put them in a burn barrel, just like these people did in Santa Cruz. And I don't know whether there's any ceremony. It seems like, were they playing a bugle? These guys are into playing bugles, you know. Maybe they did. But in any event, they burned the flag. That's how you get rid of them. So it's all pretty crazy. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werbe here with you on the Night Call Show. If you have email for me, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And you can look at my website, peterwerbe.com. Nothing for sale, but interesting stuff there. I don't even know what the hell's on there now. Is it up there? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you about that in a second. But Rush Limbaugh, I love that. He got caught with Viagra. And so he has this prescription drug. Guy's got a problem with prescription drugs not being in his name. He was an OxyContin addict, and so he managed to escape in a manner that none of the people that he always criticized, being druggies like him, were able to do. But so he got off, but he got on probation. And but one of the things he did, he couldn't possess prescription drugs. So he's coming back from the DR, the Dominican Republic, with Viagra, and it's not in his name. Turns out because he didn't want the embarrassment. Although, gee, I mean, isn't this who's that guy? The senator from Kansas, Dole, Senator Bob Dole. We're doing ads for it, so everybody figures that a little help, right? Better than the embarrassment of whatever. What is it? ED, right? Erectile. I'm sorry to keep sipping this stuff, but you can tell my sounds like the middle of winter for me, at least. Rather than the embarrassment of erectile dysfunction, or as my wife misheard it, reptile. She says, "What's reptile dysfunction? What the hell are they talking about?" So ED. So he didn't want it. But what I have on my site is this link to something: sex tourism. The DR, Dominican Republic, unfortunately, has a lot of that going on, as many countries do around the world. So what was he doing there? I mean, he didn't come with a female companion, but he brought Viagra. These guys are such hypocrites. But what did that remind me of? Oh, yeah, my website. Something really, I don't know, kind of just minor in the scope of things, but representative of what happens often in this country. There's a number of people, mostly faith-based, that have been protesting against the Iraq war and occupation since it began by having a Monday afternoon vigil, 4:45 to 5:45, every Monday at Woodward and 9 Mile in Ferndale, Michigan. And there's usually 6-8 people. Sometimes they get up to about 15 people. And people honk. They used to have signs saying, if you're against the war, if you want to impeach Bush, or stuff like that, honk. So the Ferndale cops came along and said, you can't ask people to honk because it's against the law to honk unless you're trying to avoid an accident. You don't want to be a honky, right? So one of the people, let me see if I got his name here. Oh, yeah, Victor Cotilla. He changed his sign that said I don't have all the details here, but I'm pretty sure the sign said, and you can go to my site and see the details. If the Ferndale police say don't honk if you want Bush out. Don't honk if you want Bush out. So this Ferndale cop comes up and wants to take his sign. There's a little tussle. He threatens to taser these people. Now, I don't know who's there, but very frequently there's not a lot of young people there. The people there are mostly middle-aged and older. So these are not like militants, as people label anybody they don't like. And they grabbed the sign, finally arrested him for disorderly conduct, and made him put up a $500 cash bond for having a sign in America with a constitution that guarantees the right of peaceful assembly for redress of grievances. So what we're going to do, and I use that pronoun advisedly, we are, because myself and hopefully hundreds of other people are going to assemble in Ferndale tomorrow at 4:45 p.m. on the southwest corner of Woodward and West 9 Mile Road. And we're going to have so many people there. I don't think, maybe people will have signs saying honk, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because when people see you there, they honk in support. I was at a demonstration Saturday in Warren. Actually, it was south of Detroit. South of 8 Mile Road. It was in Detroit. And people, it was a group called Women in Black. So it's mostly women, but they invite us guys along as well. So we were all there, and people were honking in agreement. And it was interesting. It was about 98% agreement, and people were giving us the thumbs up. Now, since we were in Detroit, that's primarily an African-American neighborhood, but there are a lot of people are going down Van Dyke into Warren and Roseville and what have you. The same thing from them, because we learn, even nationwide, that 2/3 of us want Iraq withdrawal. New Gallup poll finding that roughly 2 in 3 Americans urge a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, with 31% wanting this to start immediately. I don't know what the rest of people want. I want out now. Stop the killing. No more dead Americans. No more dead Iraqis. Or if there's dead Iraqis, it won't be at the hands of Americans, please. And taken together, it's perhaps fair to say, according to the director of Gallup, that a significant majority of Americans would like the United States to either withdraw troops from Iraq or make specific plans to do so. That's very important. One thing is interesting, though. The poll found that two-thirds, the other way around, felt that they understand the Bush administration's argument for staying in Iraq. I understand it. I understand it perfectly. I don't agree with it in the slightest. Only 54% understand the Democrats' view, whatever that is. I don't understand what the Democrats' view is. Do you? There's a weak need. Got their finger to the wind. Few don't. Nancy Skinner doesn't. She's running for Congress against Joe Nolenberg out in the Royal Oak and Birmingham area. Tony Trupiano, who's running against, what the hell's that guy's name? Right out of my brain. Who's in the Dearborn area. Their views are pretty clear on the war. Nancy Skinner may call in if she's still up. If not, I gave her to 11:45. She's got a lot to do tomorrow. And if so, she's going to tell you about this visit of Dick Cheney. If she doesn't call, I'll give you the information myself. All right, let's do this. Get my little mouse here and get some of you on the air. Got to press a lot of buttons. All right, give you the details. Oh, Peter Werby is my name. Night Call is the show. The phone number, 313-298-WRIF. Please call in. And here's Adam. Adam's in Ferndale. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing excellent. Thanks for calling.
Good. I've got a lot of respect for you and your opinions, and I have a thought about our Middle East policies that I haven't really heard discussed before, and I kind of wanted to bounce it off you and see what you think about it.
Please.
It seems to me that the biggest issue that Islamic society has with the United States is that we are on their holy lands by having our presence in the Middle East. That is their biggest reason for having this war with us.
Uh-huh.
So no one really discusses anything about the U.S. withdrawing from the Middle East as a whole and kind of rethinking our policies. Obviously, the big issue is oil, and it seems like if something were negotiated in a long-term price fix for oil, that we could maybe think about something along those lines and truly put an end to the quote-unquote war on terror.
Well, Adam, you are definitely on to something. Who knows what people that are willing to employ violence to bring about their goals would do, but it would take a lot of the anger out of the people who see themselves as the victims of U.S. imperial policy over the last 50 years if we would do certain things like withdraw all of our troops from the Middle East immediately, and if we would tell Israel that you have to make a definitive peace treaty with the Palestinians based on real equity. Or we're just not giving you billions and billions and billions of dollars a year, most of which is spent on war material, which then they use as they are now to destroying part of Gaza under the pretext of searching for this one soldier, which is BS. I mean, they had this plan for a long time. They want to violently overthrow the Hamas government. This all can be settled, but it the United States has to A, withdraw from the Middle East, and B, insist that our client in the Middle East, Israel, do what is best for the people, everyone in the region, or we're just not giving them any more money. I think that would go a long way. All right, thank you very much, Adam. Let me go to Stanley in Garden City. Stanley, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, welcome back. How was your 4th of July, man?
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I had a call in. I call in time to time, but I want to touch off on that flag burning issue. And my basis for the call is I hang my flag upside down every time that there's soldiers killed in Iraq.
Wow.
I'm in Garden City, and my neighbors, they're a bunch of bubble people living in the world of Republicans and stuff, believing that everything's okay and the stock market's fine. But I have a right to hang my flag upside down. It's a distress call. It goes back to your original datas, you know, people hang their flag upside down. It's a distress call saying that the government's not good. It's not treating the people good.
Stanley, you got the right to do whatever you want. As far as I'm concerned, it's just these fascists that want to control what you and I do or say or what newspapers report.
right?
Yeah.
And I say this much right now, you know, it's just too damn far beyond driven. It's gone. Our government's gone. Our system, our way of life's gone. It's not coming back. But, you know, I'm an old cowboy. They're going to have to shoot me down before they do anything to make me remove my flag and do what I want with it. My family died for that right. The blood's on there, and I can burn it, do whatever I want with it. There's two forms of government, a good form and a bad form, and we're under the worst dictatorship ever known. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Stanley. Thanks for calling in to 313-298-WRIF. Let me get one more call before a break. Alan in River Rouge, what do you think about what just went before you, Alan?
Wow, man, I'm sorry to get through. I haven't talked to you in a long time, Peter Werby.
You guys got to...
I'm sorry, I just dropped something.
Oh, okay.
Hey, pretty much want to say I have support for the government, you know. I understand people that are having a problem with the situation, but it'd be kind of hard for us to do what we're doing and then just pull right out.
Why?
Well, I don't know. It'd be kind of like starting a job and quitting. Would you do that? Would you quit today?
If it was a horrible job where I was risking my life for absolutely nothing and had a boss that lied about the job to begin with, yeah, I'd get out of there in a heartbeat.
Well, I kind of understand that, but see, I guess I shouldn't start off this way, but I don't know. I really support it, but I understand why people are losing their faith in the government.
Do you
the
think?
Thing I want to say about is back during World War One. Certain publications were put out in Germany at the same time that caused people to lose faith in their war at that time. You understand what I'm saying?
I don't think that anybody published under the Kaiser. Anti-war publications, but anti-war publications and labor publications and anyone who opposed the war during World War One in this country suffered everything from jail to beatings to lynching. But I'm willing to bet, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I suspect if I ask you this question, you will not know the answer. Why did the United States enter World War One?
How?
No, why?
Because the so-called sinking of the Lusitania.
Well, as it turned out, and Wilson knew this, the Lusitania was secretly carrying munitions and good for you that you knew that. That's the official explanation. Unrestricted submarine warfare, including the sinking of the Lusitania that had American citizens on board. But the Cunard line was jeopardized, all those people, by secretly sending United States armaments and munitions to Britain, breaking their status as neutrality and making the Lusitania a legitimate target. And Wilson knew this. All right. I gotta go. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
Gotta fuck, get a song.
Can I get a holla holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That
rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We were talking about lots of stuff, including flag burning, and this is kind of interesting. I said I didn't know what was happening in Canada. Alan writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. According to the Canadian Heritage website, it says, disposal of flags. When a flag becomes tattered and is no longer in a suitable condition for use, it should be destroyed in a dignified way by burning it privately. Wow, man. I don't know. How do you get rid of your flag? Here's one thing I've often thought about, and tell me if this isn't flag desecration. In the area around Pleasant Ridge, and I think in some areas in Ferndale, that realtors put out these plastic flags, at least now they say made in the United States. One year they were made in China. But these plastic flags, little small ones, and they put them, they go around and they put them on every person's lawn. Great show of patriotism for the 4th of July, right? Well, except they have their business card on it. So what it's really is an advertisement. And, you know, many businesses do that. They try to use the flag as a display item. Ever seen these car lots that have like 40 American flags on it? What is that? I had a friend from Germany one time. We were driving down the street. He says, yeah, today is a holiday. I said, no, why do you say that? He said, why are there so many flags out? I said, I don't know. This is the way it is, man. That is the way it is. This is from Kim. I think I can say her name, which you won't object. Kim Redigan, who first told me about this incident in Ferndale, Michigan, a couple of weeks ago, where the Ferndale police arrested someone for having a sign that said, the Ferndale police say, don't honk if you want to, what is it, get rid of Bush or whatever it said. And she said, I passed on your phone number, she said, to the Code Pink Fasters. Now, there's a fast going on, a fast for peace, put together by Medea Benjamin, who founded Code Pink, and also Global Exchange. You can Google those things. My friend Peter and I, not me, joined the fasters at the gates of the White House Thursday in time to don pink party hats and sing happy birthday to our commander and thief. The fasters are strong and resolute and have set up a great camp in Lafayette Park. There's Camp Casey that Cindy Sheehan set up in Crawford, Texas. There's now a Camp Democracy in Lafayette Park. And Kim says, let's all join the Bring Them Home fast, if only for a day or two. Don't forget to come to 9 Mile and Woodward at 4:45 tomorrow to say no to this obscene war and occupation and yes to First Amendment rights in solidarity. Kim, I don't know whether you're listening. You can do that on the Internet. But there it is. Well, speaking about Canada, so anyways, asking you about how, if you're in Canada, do you get rid of your flag? Or how do you get in the United States? There are so many flags. I mean, come on, don't you just throw them out or something? I can't believe that every single person that has a flag is having a ceremony, burning them for out-of-service flags. And certainly these plastic flags that get put everywhere. And what about the flags that are the bottoms of the bikinis or shirts and stuff like that? But speaking of Canada, Canada has its own George W. Bush now, unfortunately. And it's the prime minister. And since we live in the United States real close, right here, we're broadcasting about 8.5 miles from Windsor, our neighbor to the south. Yeah, check your map. You'll see that Windsor is to the south of Detroit. And you all know his name, right? You know who the prime minister of Canada is, the Conservative Party. Yeah, right. Stephen Harper is his name. He recently announced the most aggressive upgrade of Canada's military equipment in decades, carrying out new expenditures of $15.3 billion to improve transportation capacities. This new spending fulfills Harper's campaign promises and did not come as a big surprise, but it represented the biggest break in policy by the new and mostly cautious Conservative government from 13 years of Liberal previous governments. That's the name of the party, the Liberal Party. That was the ruling party. The Liberals reduced military spending to a low of $8.4 billion in 1998, one of the lowest per capita among industrialized countries, which I think is excellent, don't you? But as Canada takes part in more global aid missions, stretches its military muscles in Afghanistan, that the government has made a case that the military needs more mobility and muscle. I've said before that I think that Canada ought to disband its army, that it shouldn't have an army. What in the hell does Canada need an army for? there's only one country that would ever invade Canada, and that's the United States. The United States has contingency plans to invade Canada and occupy Canada. I mean, they're not going to do it. I don't mean that they're planning it. But the United States has invasion and occupation plans, contingency plans for every single country in the world. Liechtenstein and Andorra may only have a 3x5 card, but believe it, the European countries, South American countries, Mexico, and what have you, they don't want to be pulled up short. And the United States sees its imperial interest as necessitating a military presence and the ability to extend military power anywhere and everywhere in the world. So you believe it, dear Canadian listeners, that there is a file that has a complete plan for the invasion of your country, and you couldn't stand up to the United States Army. So why even have an army? And given the fact that there are problems with some of the social programs in Canada, like the National Health Program, why the hell would Canada be spending an additional $15.3 billion on military hardware, probably all bought from the United States, instead of investing that in the people of Canada? So disband the Canadian Army. You don't need it. Roger from Chatham at the Maple City Bakery wrote to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, I came across this website long ago, and not long ago, and thought you might take a look at it. OntarioUSA.org. What do you think of Ontario joining the USA? He says, I don't think it would be a good move on our part. How about Michigan joining Canada? What do you think about that? Hey, oh, this is great. I didn't realize. I'm sorry. I'm talking away. And here's my old pal, Nancy Skinner, running for Congress against Joe Nolenberg. Nancy, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hey, good to hear your voice, my friend.
And Nancy and I were colleagues on the old IE America radio network. And most recently, she broadcast on a radio station here in Detroit as a morning talk show host and quit to take on Republican Joe Nolenberg in the 9th Congressional District. Well, I actually mentioned that you may be calling, but you tell the story. Vice President Dick Cheney coming to town.
That's it.
Yeah. So what's
that's
up with that?
That's the story. We have the Vice President gracing our area tomorrow. You may have seen it on the news. He'll be at the Troy Marriott. He's going over to Selfridge. So, touring Selfridge, first of all, the Air National Guard unit there, and then coming over to do a $1,000 a plate fundraiser for Joe Nolenberg and other Republican congressional candidates at the Troy Marriott. And so I've just listening to the news all day, Peter, and today 42, did you hear this? Unarmed Iraqis were executed in the street after Shiite militias identified them as Sunnis. Later in the day, 19 more were killed in a two car bombs in the same neighborhood. I mean, this is, it's escalating violence. And so I just said, that's enough. I've decided I'm going to go out there and speak tomorrow at noon at the Troy Marriott and do a press conference because, I don't understand how the vice president can come here. He doesn't attend any funerals. You know that President Bush admitted last week he hasn't attended a single funeral of a U.S. serviceman killed over there, a man or woman, and Vice President Dick Cheney as well. And they, of course, don't allow the pictures of the flag-draped coffins to be shown on television to the U.S. public as well. So I just decided, you can't have it both ways here. You're not leading on our oil dependency, and you're not asking a sacrifice for Americans, even as you ask our soldiers to give the ultimate sacrifice. And I think this is a great opportunity for us in this area to go out there, show up at the Troy Marriott at noon, take a stand. You can't have it both ways, Mr. Vice President. You can't stay the course on this war in Iraq and stay the course on the oil dependency and do nothing about it. You know how invested this administration is in the oil industry. And Joe Nolenberg, my opponent's the same way. He took $56,000 from oil companies and voted no on cracking down on gouging. He voted no on alternative fuels. It's just really terrible positions, and I don't understand how people can not make the connection between those two things, oil dependency and the war in Iraq and do nothing about it. And so I'm going to go speak out tomorrow at a press conference, and I'm hoping people will join me and stand with me as we, speak loudly and clearly that we won't let them have it both ways.
Well, Nancy Skinner, why would Joe Nolenberg want the vice president, Dick Cheney, who has a popularity rating of about 26%?
18.
Well, it's gone down. I mean, a lot of candidates don't even want Bush to show up in their district.
You know what? The truth is he wants money more than he cares about that. That has to be in the final decision. You're running for office. You want, and I would like to think it's because he realizes what a great threat I am, Peter, and he needs that money. So he's willing to take that risk and that political hit because he needs that money to spend against me in November.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you that. Most people would think, hey, Joe Nolenberg, Birmingham, Republicans, this must be just a symbolic attempt by Nancy Skinner to unseat this right-wing Republican.
No, not at all. What people don't realize about the district is that it's changed a lot. Now, Oakland County has changed. It's our district, the 9th congressional district. But Jennifer Granholm won the district. Senator Levin won the district. And John Kerry got 49% of the vote here. So technically, it is being nationally considered a 50-50 district. And we don't have many of those in the country, you know, because of redistricting. So absolutely not. It is not a symbolic chance. And with the poll numbers for Republicans in general this year, they will give you anywhere from 10 to 15 points just because everyone is so upset with one party controlling all three branches and what they've done over the last 6 years. And the fact that I have ovaries gives me a few extra points there, Peter.
Women,
he had a strong woman run against him.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you one more. Oh, yeah. Where, when Cheney or Bush, when they fly somewhere for these fundraisers, and who's paying the tab here? Who's paying the gas on Air Force Two that Cheney's going to come winging into Selfridge on?
You and me and the rest of the taxpayers, because he's going to go visit Selfridge, tour the, you know, National Guard facility there, and then head over to a $1,000 plate fundraiser, and they expect 250 people to attend. So, I mean, that's what's crazy. Do you think, honestly, he needs to tour our, the vice president needs to come out and do that? No, of course not. They use that as an excuse to justify these fundraising tours, and they're happening all over the country. Now, President Bush is not welcome in a lot of congressional districts, but somehow, some way, because Joe Nolenberg votes with President Bush 98% of the time, so I'm not sure why he wouldn't just go and have the president come, but they have decided it's a good move for them to have the vice president, Dick Cheney.
Well, let me sum up here. Nancy Skinner is going to be holding a press conference tomorrow at noon at the Troy Marriott at 200 West Big Beaver Road in Troy, and you'd like people to join you. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, and if people want to go to your website, is it Skinner for Congress?
That's right. Skinner. www.skinner4congress.com. Peter, this is we can play a really key role here in this election. Our district is one of those we're being targeted nationally. Joe Trippi has joined my campaign. You know who ran Howard Dean's presidential campaign?
Uh-huh.
And his campaign manager that ran all of Michigan, Howard Dean, will be here tomorrow. And we have great local people. Our office is on Woodward Avenue in Birmingham at 14.5 miles. We need volunteers. We need contributions. But you know what? All that stuff. I feel it. I feel that people are just, they've had enough. And so this can be the year that we help take back the House of Representatives and at least, you know, add that one element. And 2008 is another story, but if we take back one of those houses, then we won't have to suffer another 2 years of this nonsense that we've been going here through.
Well, Nancy Skinner, I think you're going to win. Thanks for joining us.
Peter, great to hear you. Okay, keep up the good work.
All right, bye-bye now. And I guess this means I'm going to Joe, if you're listening, Joe Nolenberg, Nancy Skinner's opponent, the incumbent, feel free to call 313-298-WRIF. Here's Wayne in Detroit. Wayne, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, Peter, I just wanted to say this is more like the unfortunate we, which is us, the people. And for a simple little thing like a car horn, you can't honk your horn. I honk at about everything. Girls, I honk at people here and there. There's people honking at other people when they're in the turn signal lanes. There's people at weddings. I guess the kids need a ride in the back and hit a little paper plate with a silver fork. Dig. And it's in honor of things is the reason why people honk. And whenever I hit anybody or they hit me, there was no horn involved. Dig. And that's about all I want to say. And that's
right.
To the police. Period.
Sounds right. Like you're a honky, Wayne. All right. Thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Some open lines for you. The honking part of it is there's a demonstration tomorrow in Ferndale, 445 to 545. Woodward 9 Mile in Ferndale. And that's because the Ferndale police arrested someone who had a sign that said the Ferndale police say, don't honk if you want to, if you want Bush out. So it's going to be hundreds of people there. Come out and express yourself against Bush's war and against this attempt to limit our freedom of speech. All right, let's see here. Let's go to Ken. Ken is in Waterford. Ken, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How are you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Good. You were talking earlier about overpopulation issues and an essay that you recommended that we all read.
Yeah.
What essay was that called?
It's called Planet of Slums, and it's available online if you have internet access. Planet of Slums, and it's by Mike Davis. And I would recommend any book by Mike Davis, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's your position on that? I must have missed that part.
What, on population?
Overpopulation.
Well, it's interesting. It's kind of a complex subject, but it's pretty clear that there are too many people in this world, vastly too many. I don't know. I have no idea how we'd settle this. We'd do a lot better with about 5 billion less people.
There's only 6 billion in the world right now.
I know. So
having 1 billion people would be ideal.
Well, that's what I think. I mean, we wouldn't have such an impact on the world's environment. In fact, it could be very much so that the expansion and the total domination of one species will could sink the planet as we know it now. I don't know how we can keep this pattern of industrialized, what are they, petrochemical industrial society going and not ruin the entire world. Doesn't look good.
I definitely support an all-natural type of lifestyle, meaning and to not pollute the earth that God has given us. So, yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. But what I would disagree with you on is that the world in general is overpopulated. I've seen statistics showing that for 6 billion people, you could fit everyone in the Grand Canyon.
Well, that might wind up happening. But, yeah, people say it's over, Africa's overpopulated. Well, Africa's not overpopulated. One of the highest population densities in the world is in the Netherlands, for instance, or in Manhattan. And what it really is about is that people do not have, it gets back into income and wealth distribution. So there is enough wealth in this world that no one has to live these lives of grinding poverty that we see, or live in these slums that Mike Davis talks about in his essay, Planet of Slums. But even still, if you started bringing up the standard of living of what we call the developing nations to that of our country, into the West in general, industrialized technological society, that amount of plastics, that amount of garbage, that amount of exhaust, all of that will sink the planet. We have to think of something different.
Sure.
That what?
Well, at our current level of consumption, of course, the materials that we're using, mainly in the United States and Western Europe, yeah, I would agree with you completely on that. But if I don't believe that the world and in general is living the way that God intended, in harmony with the planet.
Well, we should be living more like Adam and Eve, probably.
Agreed. A more agricultural.
Agricultural.
Yeah, agricultural.
Yeah. And maybe dressed.
Society.
It may be dressed, too, particularly in the winter time. Probably we could all go nude during this period, but I don't know. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's go quickly to Jerry in Detroit. Jerry, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great.
Hey, on your issue of flag burning.
Yeah.
Well, I'm ex-military, and you know, there was a difference between not throwing away a flag and destroying a tapered flag that really, you know, you destroy it so that it just doesn't end up in the garbage and end up at some dump. It's not the same as burning it. Just to burn a flag just because it's your constitutional right. You know, I have no problem with your constitutional rights and giving you the freedom to do things, but, you know, just to get out there and to burn a flag, just to do it, it's just, I don't agree with it. I don't think
most Americans agree with it, but people do the damnedest things. And see, one thing you got to, when you have laws, you got to show harm and making people angry. Like this show makes people angry, and there are some people that actually try to intervene with the management here to not allow me to speak anymore. Because I make them so angry, because I'm saying things that they don't like, and they don't think I should be critical of the president, and they don't think I should be critical of foreign policy, and what have you. I don't know why they don't just call here or email me, because the management is not sympathetic to it limiting my or yours ability to speak your mind on this show. But you can't, we don't want to make laws because something makes people angry.
Well, I have no problem with your speech and the way your views are, even though I might not agree with them. I fought for this country just to be able to stand up for those rights. If you have a view, fine. As much as it might make me uncomfortable, it's still your view, and that's what makes this country great, is listening to your view and counteracting with my view, and maybe sure. We can come to an agreement in between the two. But just to go out there and burn it, just to burn it, because I can, whether or not there should be a law to stop that or not, I don't, my personal view is I don't agree with it, because I think you're desecrating a symbol of this country.
Well, yeah, but that's what they intend to do. That is, but
why do it?
I don't know. Here's what I'm not quite sure, because mostly people that are involved in political acts want to communicate effectively. And that's the most ineffective way to communicate imaginable. For one thing, television news cameras are always looking for images. So you could have like 100,000 people saying we should have a national health program, and somebody's going to say, well, I'm going to burn a flag, and that's all you'd see on television. I got to take a quick break. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
This is WRIF.com.
your night call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Ann. This is our second hour. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, I give the time zone because many of you are listening across the country and even around the world. We're going to have a couple of real interesting interviews. What the hell are they about? Why do I always get a mental block on all this? Oh, I know. I can go to my webpage. Then that tells what it is. Peter Werby, PeterWerbe.com. Dean Kuipers is going to join us. He wrote a book called Burning Rainbow Farm, How a Stoner Utopia Went Up in Smoke. Now, do you remember that? There were these two guys that ran this farm down in southwestern Michigan. And they always would have, like, marijuana festivals. They really blew it, wound up getting killed by the FBI. So we're going to have the story of that. And also, Mary Wynne Ashford, she wrote a book called Enough Bloodshed, 101 Solutions to Violence, Terror, and War. So that's at 1 a.m. Stay tuned for that. Did I want to tell you one more thing? Oh, yeah, this was incredible, but it seems to have disappeared. Oh, yeah. Here it is. Always, what's my little phrase? I can't remember my own phrases. Over-prepared and under-organized. We got all these stories. I got probably do 10 hours on this. Now, I thought this was curious when it happened. This couple of years ago, you got to go back. On October 29, 2004, this is, by the way, from Consortium News, C-O-N-S-O-R-T-I-U-M, Consortium, looks like Consortium, consortiumnews.com. Interesting website. This, according to the CIA, Osama bin Laden helped Bush in 2004. I know it was one of these crackpot conspiracy sites. Now, on October 29, 2004, just 4 days before the U.S. presidential election, al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, or Osama bin Forgotten, as we call him here, released a videotape denouncing George W. Bush. How interesting. Some Bush supporters quickly spun the diatribe as Osama's endorsement of John Kerry. And I was thinking, oh, man, this is going to help Kerry. What's the matter with this guy? Does he want Bush to stay in office? In other words, the arch enemy of the United States, the man universally perceived as being responsible for 9/11, has just denounced George W. Bush in a close, close election. So close that many of us, including me, believe it was stolen. That's another story. So this article continues. But behind the walls of the CIA, analysts have concluded the opposite, that bin Laden was trying to help Bush gain a second term. The stunning CIA disclosure is tucked away in a brief passage near the end of Ron Suskind's book, The 1% Doctrine, which I believe is on the New York Times bestseller list. Ron Suskind, S-U-S-K-I-N-D, The 1% Doctrine, which draws heavily from CIA insiders. Suskind wrote that the CIA analysts based their troubling assessment on classified information, but the analysts still puzzled over exactly why bin Laden wanted Bush to stay in office. Pretty obvious to me, but let's continue. According to Suskind's book, CIA analysts had spent years parsing each expressed word of the al-Qaeda leader. While they've learned what they've learned over nearly a decade is that bin Laden speaks only for strategic reasons. This is from the book. The CIA's assessment at day's end are a distillation of the kind of secret internal conversations that the American public was not sanctioned to hear, strategic analysis. Today's conclusion, bin Laden's message was clearly designed to assist the president's re-election. So you think, wait a minute, isn't this the guy, Bush, that said bin Laden dead or alive? Well, it's kind of a joke, but that has brought the war to the Middle East? Wait a minute, now we're beginning to see what's going on here. This is more from the book. At the 5 o'clock meeting, Deputy CIA Director John McLaughlin opened the issue with the consensus view bin Laden certainly did a nice favor for the president. McLaughlin's comment drew nods from CIA officers at the table. But the CIA analysts also felt that bin Laden might have recognized how Bush's policies, including the Guantanamo prison camp, the Abu Ghraib scandal, and endless bloodshed in Iraq, were serving al-Qaeda's strategic goals for recruiting a new generation of jihadists. Doesn't that make an incredible amount of sense? Certainly, said a CIA's, where's this guy, Jamie Misick. He would want Bush to keep doing what he's doing for a few more years, according to Suskind's account of the meeting. So we're not safer. George W. Bush and these absolutely mad, incompetent people that inhabit illegally the White House and carried out this illegal war. In fact, everything they do is illegal. Illegal spying. Illegal tracking our phone calls. Illegal tracking finances. All of it. All right. Let's see. Where are we going next? Here's Al. Al's in Inkster. Al, hi. It's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Pete. How you doing?
Good.
I have to disagree with you. I think Canada needs an army, and they ought to invade us to save us from ourselves and the world from us.
There you go.
Called in to talk about immigration. I was talking to some people at work, and they were sitting there going, you know, if you really want to get rid of illegal immigrants, what you ought to start doing is pay everybody a fair wage.
There you go.
He was talking about, he lives up in the thumb, and a lot of Mexicans up there doing agricultural work, and he was like, there's some Mexicans in front of me cashing their paycheck at the party store the other day, and I saw the size of that paycheck, and I was like, that's all they make?
Huh. Well, that's one little aspect of it. What we ought to recognize, though, that because there's this artificial land where the United States in the late 1840s grabbed as much as when that was in the Mexican War, was something like that.
The Treaty of Guadalupe, I think it is, or Hidalgo.
Yeah.
They promised to protect the old Spanish land grants and promptly stole all the land.
Stole California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, all of which was historically part of Mexico. So the line that delineated the border of the United States and Mexico is truly artificial. And people, one side of it, Hupchik, one side of it do well or relatively well. People on the other side do poorly. So what's going on here? Are the Mexican people less industrious or not as smart or what have you? You could either come up with racist explanations, which would say that there's a racial difference on this artificial line that is drawn by men with guns, or that there are political and economic reasons why one country winds up benefiting at the expense of the other. And that's why we're getting illegal immigrants. Until that is solved, it's going to continue.
Well, that, it's a political tactic where they pick and prey on the weak and, the weak and the powerless, basically blaming the victims.
You got it. Thank you, Al. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Dan. Dan's in Detroit. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks, Peter. It's my first time calling. I always listen to your show. I really love it.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to touch base real quick on the oil consumption.
Okay.
And how all the big three oil companies are talking about, they're putting so much money into alternative methods for oil.
Sure.
And I think it's one of the biggest lies that I've heard. Like, yeah, sure, they are putting money into it, but to find a reliable source would be really easy. I mean, for example, my friend's dad, he was a teacher at the Michigan Automotive Academy.
Uh-huh.
He's got his own lab set up where he can convert a diesel-fueled car to run on vegetable oil.
Yeah, that's right. Biodiesel.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very easy, in fact.
He says it costs him like 50 cents a gallon to run his car.
Yeah.
I mean, and if he can do that out of his garage, how is it that the three big oil companies can't incorporate the same method for their cars?
Well, they could. Do you know what Willie Nelson runs his biodiesel car on? Hemp oil.
No.
Hemp oil. Yeah.
That would be Willie Nelson.
Yeah, that would be Willie. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, it's just, here they are making, I'm quoting CNN here, $36 billion last year in net income, in profit for ExxonMobil.
Sure.
$36 billion, that would be a heck of an easy conversion over to biodegradable or biodiesel fuel.
Well, I'll tell you, all of these issues are contained in this documentary that I saw that I believe is playing in Detroit. I think it's playing at the main theater in Royal Oak, but it may be other places as well. It's called Who Killed the Electric Car? In the late 1990s, California mandated that they had to have 10% zero emission cars by, I forgot the target date, sometime around now. So GM started producing these electric cars, and then what this documentary looks at is how GM and the oil companies destroyed this both the mandate and virtually destroyed the cars. They collected all the cars, these electric cars, and there were, I don't know how many. That's interesting. I can't remember whether there was hundreds or thousands, at least hundreds of these electric cars in California operating just fine. The owners love them. And GM, I think they were only leasing them, got them all back and actually trashed them all. It's an amazing story. So I would highly recommend that. Thank you, Dan. Let's go to hell and talk to Jennifer, who's in Hell, Michigan. How you doing, Jennifer?
I'm doing all right.
Good. You're on the air. Go ahead.
First off, when you guys were talking about the environmental stuff, there is a series in the fiction books, but the guy knows what he's talking about, by Ben Bova. He's a sci-fi writer.
Okay.
He's been around since, God, he's been writing since, like, the 50s, I think. And he used to actually be part of NASA, and he's got a series of books that is the Grand Tour novels, nicknamed by his fans. And they pretty much, I believe, is what might happen to Earth coming up soon to us. It goes over changing, going out into space and getting our resources from space. Living on the moon. If you read the books, though, they're very realistic.
I would suggest also, which I haven't seen, but I've seen enough of it, and I've been reading a lot about it, and I am going to see it, is Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth. That, by the way, has turned out to be the third highest grossing documentary of all times.
Yeah, I want to see it at some point.
You know what the number one top grosser is?
Mm-mm.
Fahrenheit 9/11 by our own Michael Moore. You know what number two is? Bowling for Columbine by our own Michael Moore.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's
I mean, they're worth reading, and I mean, they are fiction, but I mean, he's got a lot of realistic things that could possibly happen. And there's also a mention of a greenhouse cliff. Where pretty much everything just goes awry earth-wise, and I think there's a lot of truth to them.
Wait a minute. Though on the screen here, it says you wanted to talk about Governor Jennifer Granholm.
Was the other thing. I was, I'm just trying to get some information more than anything, but I was wondering what your views on the whole election. I've seen a few things on the other guy. What's his name?
DeVos.
It almost sounds like, I'm at least on his flyers and paper, he's almost Democratic, but he's a hardcore Republican.
He's
bothering the hell out of him.
Right, he's hardcore Republican and hardcore right wing. He's got the most skillful publicists that are portraying him as a successful businessman. He didn't do anything. He inherited the business from his father, the founder.
The company
hasn't done as well since. And he's really into destroying unions and really into repealing taxes for the wealthy. I don't know that I'm going to go up and down the street cheering for Jennifer Granholm, but to have a legislature dominated by the Republicans and having a right-wing governor like DeVos, I think, would be disastrous. Absolutely disastrous.
That's what I was thinking, too. I'm just wondering why he's trying to portray himself more as a Republican, especially since...
I mean, why is he trying to portray himself as a Democrat?
Yeah.
Well, why do you think? Why do you think George W. Bush? Do you think what he said? Hey, people, I'm a far right-wing Republican that has this stealth agenda to begin this war in Iraq, which he had before going into office in 2000, that I'm going to repeal all these safety and environmental regulations, that I'm going to give all these tax breaks to the wealthy, that I'm going to repeal environmental laws, and I'm going to break all these international treaties. I'm going to operate this government in total secrecy. I'm going to begin spying on people. I'm going to try to create a situation where I don't allow any debate or dissent, which is their goal, this totalitarian goal that the Bush right-wing agenda is. Well, no one would vote for him. As it is, people didn't vote for him. The majority of people voted for Al Gore in 2000. But what he said was, I'm a uniter, which was a total lie. This country is split because of these far right wingers, worse than it's been in a generation or two. So DeVos is just doing the same thing. the same stealth campaign. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let me, I just want to take this call, hoping it's who I think it is, Patrick from Ann Arbor. Is this my pal, Patrick? No, I guess not. Hey. All right, I'm gonna put in that person. God. Wow. What does this mean? War on Patrick. Maybe it's not. I have a friend named Patrick there. Let's take this one first. I think this may be someone I know as well. Susan in Oak Park.
Hello, Peter.
This is Susan, my pal. Hi.
Yes. How are you? It's been a while since I've been on the air, but I'm really concerned about something that's going on right now at the Rainbow Gathering.
Yeah. Remind people what the Rainbow Gathering has been going on.
The Rainbow Gathering of Love and Light is from July 1st to the 7th, with people going earlier to set up and people staying later to bring the planet and where they're at in the environment, back to how it was before they got there, or better.
And this was started like 25 years ago, and it's what people call, I don't know if you'd identify them or I would, as hippies, right?
Well, there's all kinds of people there, but they go on the 4th to pray for world peace. 10 to 20,000 people in a circle.
And it was in Colorado this year.
Yes, near Steamboat Springs.
Right.
But I'm kind of concerned because a lot of people, I usually get a phone call or someone's back by now, and there was in the newspaper there near Steamboat Springs a small article about 4 or 5 days ago saying unruly campers have attacked forest rangers. But I did get an email that said the other way around. They said something to do with Homeland Security and with the National Guard, and they surrounded them. And I wanted to wait until after the 7th because a lot of times there's rumors and a lot of times some things happen, but they're kind of minor or just a few incidences.
Well, I know, Susan, I saw an article that said the Rainbow Gathering had been heavily monitored by Forest Service personnel who are armed and have the power of arrest because of the potential for forest fires. And I know that the Rainbow Gatherings, one of the features of it are these big bonfires. And even though that there had been approved sections, and as usual, the Rainbow Gathering has no official leadership, and although people take charge of responsibilities of different areas, and one of the things that they were doing was fire control, the people themselves. The Rainbow people claimed that the Forest Service was using the fire danger as an excuse to harass them. And we know that when we hear reports that, like, police or whatever clash with demonstrators, we know that cops are kicking, that heavily armed cops are kicking the crap out of people wearing flip-flops and shorts. So I hope that hasn't occurred.
Is there any way we can find out more? I mean, I haven't heard anything, and I've heard some really terrible stories, like of them not letting food and water in, and they're not helping people that are sick, and they're taking children away from their parents.
Wow.
I'm just saying we need to, I guess maybe next week I could call back or something.
Please,
if somebody
do.
Knows anything, maybe they'll call in this hour, too. I would really like to know what's going on.
And well, me too. I hope people will call. Thank you, Susan. We'll put out a call for that. 313-298-WRIF. Let me try Patrick again. Patrick?
Yes, Peter.
Patrick, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, Peter, I was hoping you could make an announcement. When I heard you mention great documentaries, I sent you an email earlier about a film produced by Michael Franti about his visit to Iraq, where he did music, met with soldiers, met with local Iraqis. That's going to be showing this week in Detroit. I don't have the exact details in front of me, but I was hoping you could pass that on, try to increase the exposure for people in our community about this great upcoming film.
Well, yeah, and also, let me see here. It is on my, I put it on my website, so on my website calendar. So if you go to Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com, that you can see the details of this. Let me get to it, and I will. You got to get a new phone, man.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Michael Franti, who is the lead singer of Spearhead. This film is going to be shown Tuesday, July 11th Central United Methodist Church, Downtown Detroit at Adams and what the hell's the name of that park there? It's across from the State Theater, you know, in front of Comerica Park. And Michael Frandi, who's a world-renowned musician, he's traveled to Iraq, Palestine, Israel, and talk with people, trying to find out what in the hell is going on. And this documentary ought to be absolutely terrific. Then Michael Frandi, you know, Patrick, there's just way too much noise on this line. I'm going to have to cut you loose, but I'll give the information, okay?
Thank you. Keep
going. All right. Whew. Michael Frandi and Spearhead. I have not ever seen Spearhead. I've got the most incredible endorsement from them. They're going to be playing Sunday night, a week from tonight, at Detroit's Diversity Festival, the Concert of Colors. I think you can just go to concertofcolors.org or .com. Let me see. I actually have a link to it. I'll tell you so you can go directly to it if you want, which is, oh, these things, they never come right up when you want them. But, oh, yeah, .org. So it's go to accesscommunity.org, accesscommunity.org/COC, and you'll get all the information on the event. All right, let's go back, and we'll talk to more people. Let's see. Let's continue this. Here's Mike listening way up in Grand Rapids. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Hey, I'm over here, actually. I work over in Detroit. I live south of Grand Rapids. I want to talk about Dick DeVos as governor.
Sure.
I know you feel he's right wing, which he is. He's extreme right wing.
Right.
What happened needs to happen is this whole side of the state needs to vote for Granholm. The whole conservative right wing side of the state of Grand Rapids there, they've already elected Dick DeVos pretty mm-hmm. much. You know, he's probably one of the most highly looked on criminals in the city of Grand Rapids.
Why do you call him a criminal?
Oh, he's got the Wyoming and Grand Rapids police under his thumb.
Yeah. I mean, he's not breaking the law, though, or is he?
Well,
I don't think so.
And whose eyes are you looking at?
Well, he runs his company that's a pyramid scheme, essentially, right?
Right, correct, Amway.
I mean, not strictly speaking, because pyramid schemes are against the law, but it's sellers getting other sellers to sell for them. It's that kind of deal. Works out for some people. Other people get screwed. But some people have made a lot of money.
But I just wanted to, I want to this side of the state to hear that, you know, if they don't want a right wing, which the vote has to come from over here in order to keep them out of office.
Well, you got to remember, the Granholm has not even begun to really campaign. And DeVos has had extraordinarily skillful publicity, ads on television, essentially, and portraying him as just a guy with his shirt sleeves rolled up, and he's a successful businessman, and he's going to get rid of the single business tax, which I guess, yeah, I think Michigan's the only country in the United States that even has that, so maybe that would be good to get rid of it. All right, thanks a lot, Mike. You made your point loud and clear. Appreciate it. Let's go to Detroit and talk to Darius. Darius, hi. You're on WRIF.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, Peter. I've been a long-time listener.
Welcome.
15 years, ever since I've been sent to Bush's war in 91.
Okay.
You've been an influence in my life.
Yeah.
I wanted to discuss population explosion. That you raised the topic about half an hour ago.
Right.
Anytime my uncle explained it to me, like, when, for example, why do people reproduce in a world where there's a poverty and there's a hunger? Why do they do it more? And whenever a species is in danger of being living in poverty, it reproduces more. Like a rat, for example, it produces more offspring.
Yeah.
Ever since, you know, and putting people in poverty, it just like looking at nature, a rat reproduces so many offspring, and even if...
Well, there's other practical reasons, too, is that poor people, and we're talking about people not so much even in the United States as in what we call the third world, they don't have access to birth control. I mean, that's why AIDS has been spreading like it has. And also, there's economic reasons. People feel that the more children they have, it's not so much that they... you would think, wow, they got more mouths to feed, but they also have more people to support them, more people that can carry out agricultural work. In the slums, I guess it probably makes a lot less sense, though, doesn't it?
Well, yes, I understand. but the primary reason is if you really make a hardship on any species, it will reproduce in more quantity than usual. If, for example, a rat wouldn't have to hide itself from predators, from humans, it would reproduce only one or two offsprings. And the same applies to our race, to the human species. For example, in Africa or anywhere else in the world,
mm-hmm.
And they just have to reproduce. It's a natural instinct of any species.
Well, in other words, when you take the pressure off a population, like in the Western industrial countries, there's a fear that there's not even a reproduction rate. In other words, we're not replacing people at, even though our population's growing, it's not, some countries are worried that the replacement rate is not keeping up with the death rate, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's less than one. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Darius. I appreciate that being in consideration. Here's Gerardo, is it?
Hello.
Welcome to the what are we doing here?
The show. Your show. Yeah.
Whatever we're doing, yeah.
Okay. Regarding the electric car, actually, these people weren't leased. These people actually owned the vehicles, and what they received in the mail was recall letters, not picture brakes or a new pump or whatever. The letters actually were recalled that they had to surrender the vehicles.
These were the electric cars,
yes,
in California. Now, how could, like Ford Motor could write a letter to me and say...
No, actually it wasn't the companies. It was from what I remember from the news report, it was like some governmental agency.
Uh-huh.
For whatever reason. If I remember correctly, I think that was like from BBC World News, and also for the woman who was asking about, was it the Rainbow, what was it, Rainbow Connection or whatever?
Yeah.
I believe that the BBC World News, and even, believe it or not, Dan Rather's old station, CBS World News, ran a story on that, where they were actually trying to starve these people out.
Wow.
I mean, I couldn't even believe this. It's like, you know, and like even they even showed like even some news crews were being chased, and you know, and some of these individuals pointing guns at them. It's, I mean.
Well, wait a minute, Gerardo. I'm sort of losing. Who's pointing guns at who?
No, that was like some of those people that what was it called?
The Rainbow Coalition? The Rainbow,
yeah.
People and the, mm-hmm, Rainbow, yeah. Gathering, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember seeing just snippets of whatever it was, and that's why, BBC World News, they usually, it seems like you have to go outside the country, the United States, to where governmental threats or anything. Yeah, I mean, just an outside source, an outside news source that can't be intimidated, you know. And unfortunately, I mean, that does raise a good question. What happened to the amendment, freedom of the press? And, of course, remember freedom of speech, because notice Dan Rather did a report on George W. Bush on a military career, which he, according to eyewitnesses and even records, that he really didn't have. And look what happened to him.
Well, yeah, that's a pretty complicated story. For one thing, the basic story about George W. Bush being AWOL for a year was essentially accurate. What the hell happened in all of that back then is way beyond me. All right, thank you, Gerardo. I appreciate that. Here, I just did a Yahoo News search. It says Rainbow Family numbers peak at 15,000. That's the Casper Star Tribune. Must be Casper, Colorado. And also another headline, officials fear forest damage in wake of Rainbow Family gathering. They always do. They don't want this to happen, and they give the Rainbow People's Gathering a hard time every single year. Rainbow Gathering marks the land. I don't see anything in here that I'm not reading the stories, but I don't, Rainbow Family All About Peace is local member of the group. So, a Puebloan. I don't know what that means. So, probably someone from Pueblo, Colorado, who's a member of the Rainbow Family, says if the group, all of the group wants a little peace, love, and understanding, Timothy Morningbird, they often have names like that, Sergeant, was among 300 people who were arrested and ticketed recently for illegal camping on Forest Service lands while gathering for a national get-together near Steamboat Springs. Sergeant said Forest Service officers were enforcing this 35th enforcing the camping. We're enforcing the camping. What the hell does that mean? In case you're wondering, here at the 35th Annual National Rainbow Gathering in the Root Medicine Bow National Forest, the Rainbow Family of Living Light keeps its members well-fed, safe, and conscious of how they approach the thousands of acres U.S. National Forest they are temporarily inhabiting. All right. Let me see. I think we do indeed have some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. I'll be right back.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment of tonight's Night Call. And remember, 1 a.m., a couple of very interesting interviews, including Burning Rainbow Farm. We're talking about the Rainbow People. This was a farm set up in southwestern Michigan near the Indiana border, which advocated the legalization of marijuana. These guys running it kind of lost it and wound up being shot to death by the FBI. Actually, one killed by the FBI, another by a state police sharpshooter, I believe. We're also talking all night about flag desecration. Now, I'm looking at a photograph sent to me by Jeremy from Livonia. Sent it into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And here's George W. Bush with, what do you call this? A Sharpie. A magic marker that you can, instead of like a ballpoint pen or something that gives broad strokes on it. And he is signing an American flag. He is writing his name for an admirer on an American flag. Is that flag desecration? What the hell? I mean, if that isn't, I don't know what is. Now, also, I mentioned earlier my old pal, Tony Trupiano. Now, both Nancy Skinner, who was on the air earlier, and Tony Trupiano were both talk show hosts who quit this profession in order to run against right-wing Republicans. And Nancy Skinner, you can go to skinner4congress.org, is running against Joe Nolenberg in the 9th District in up in Birmingham, Royal Oak, and what have you. Then around Dearborn, Tony is running against Thaddeus McCotter, thanks to Digger. I couldn't remember who the Republican was. And let's see, he also says it's a Maryland company that's producing the DeVos for Governor ads. So they're, what are they doing? What do they call that? Outsourcing. They're outsourcing that stuff. And I want to get one more thing in here. Pardon me. Let's see. Oh, yeah, this is from David. I listened to your show tonight with a friend for the first time. Good job, he says. This is an incredible story. I became a medical marijuana activist due to my son's illness and later death in 2005. I began a radio talk show in Nashville exposing a lot of New World Order anti-constitutional crap. It's a long story, but I'm now living in Kent. My kids are in custody of their aunt and uncle in Jerome, Michigan. I should have read through this, but there's a lot here. Our son who passed away, his medical bills were over $2 million and we lost everything. My wife had a complete mental breakdown 3 years ago, and I am her sole caretaker. We're staying with a friend now in Kent. He actually wants to know somebody that knows interstate child custody laws. I'll have to get to this later. I actually don't know anybody, but I will write you back. But the point being is, without a national health program, this is what happens to hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Americans, that people lose everything because they get ill. All right, 313-298-WRIF, and let's go to Chris. Chris is in Flat Rock. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
A couple of things. First thing is that over the years, there's been quite a few people who've come up with inventions that stretch how long the petroleum will go, and just the different auto companies will turn around and buy them out or give them a couple of bucks and make them shut up. There was a guy out of New Boston down here in the Downriver area, using old milk bottles, stretched the petroleum that he was using tenfold. Just his gas, he'd get 100 miles to the gallon easy.
Wait a minute, Chris. How could milk bottles have anything to do with gas mileage?
It was a way that he had set it up with the engine to limit how much was needed.
Oh.
The guy had an MIT degree and everything. He had a way of just breaking it down to where it was a lot more mileage for a smaller amount.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to understand that these both the suppliers, the oil-producing companies, or countries, rather, and the companies that pump it in and sell it across the world, the worse mileage that we get and the larger the demand, the more money they make. So this is terrific for all of them, except that it does extraordinary damage to us and burning all this fuel. In fact, every part of oil production is poisonous to the planet. And you would think that we would be doing everything we could to create technology that would give us 50, 60, 70, as you said, 100 miles a gallon looking for alternative sources. But there is such institutional resistance to it, and to the point where this country is willing to fight wars for oil, we're up against a formidable enemy and a formidable culture of fossil fuel.
Right. The other thing I wanted to talk about is I'm actually an ex-Boy Scout and used to be an assistant scoutmaster, and they have the stance that when a flag is no longer usable, they ceremoniously take it apart and burn it.
Right.
Where it's no longer a solid, complete flag, they take it down to the stripes themselves and stars themselves, and burn barrel it goes.
What do you mean? They
ceremoniously.
They cut it up?
Well, what they do is they take out the stitches, and then it goes into the burn barrel.
Boy.
Yeah. But you're talking about Bush signing the flag. That's bigger desecration than graciously disposing of a very badly beaten up flag.
I guess. I usually the only time that people object to the flag being misused is when it's used for a political statement. And because, you can do anything to it. You can sit on it. You can put it on a plastic bag that's going to be thrown away and all of that. So that's okay. As soon as it's used for a political statement, people go bonkers.
Yeah, and they don't even have to burn it when they use it for the political statement for people to notice.
Say that one again.
Anytime that the flag is used in a demonstration, it gets attention. They don't even have to actually burn it to get attention.
Yeah, yeah. All right, thank you so much, Chris. Appreciate you calling in from Flat Rock. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Samuel. Samuel, hi. You're on Night Call. Welcome to the broadcast.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Yes, I'm a double vet. I've been World War One and Two. And I've been in Detroit since 1904. Detroit used to be one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Every backyard had cherry trees, plum trees, apple trees, pear trees. But what I wanted to talk about...
Hey, Samuel, could you do me a favor? Could you turn your radio completely off?
Okay.
Because we're on a something-second delay. Now, Samuel,
there you go.
Samuel,
okay.
Were you really born in 1898?
24th of May.
Boy. Wow, so you've been around a while. You've seen it all.
I was born in Cuba, but Cuba got its freedom in 1900. So I was born under the American flag. I was born an American citizen.
Okay.
But now, they spoke about the electric cars that General Motors took out of California. They took everything out of Detroit electric. The street cars and the electric coaches. That was done by Standard Oil, U.S. Rubber, and General Motors.
You are right.
And the most people don't realize this jive about Bush going into Iraq for the benefit of the country. It was a vendetta because Hussein had out a $1 billion bounty for his father.
Yeah.
I know about that, too.
You do. You know a lot. I'm interested, though. About you. So you were you in the armed services in World War One?
World War One and World War Two.
Wow, wow. So you're a double vet.
I'm a veteran. I went to a VA. Just had my leg amputated in 03. I was 105 when I had my leg amputated because of a blood clot.
Boy,
but I'm in the best of health.
You sound it.
And as I say. If they would quit using the word race, this would be a beautiful world. There's only one race, that's the human race, unless you go into car races, horse races, donkey races. But that's only a thing to keep people separated. And poor people are too dumb to realize it's only an implement to keep them separated.
Yeah, well,
many people don't care what color you are. If you're a black man and got $1 billion, you're a white man as far as they're concerned.
There you go. It all is.
Mexican, Japanese, whatever. It makes no difference if you've got money. But in order to keep the people fighting among themselves, they use this race bait.
Well,
when I come to Detroit,
you
could go any place you wanted to, any time of day or night. Police didn't harass you. Nobody harassed you. But what brought all this on? During World War II, I was a teacher up at Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, what they call the limited service school. Men that couldn't read or write from the South came to the North, and they sent them to the limited service school. I'm going to give you, for instance, how bad off those people were. On the application test, it said, name three cities in the United States. They didn't know a thing about Philadelphia, New York, or Detroit, or Los Angeles. They would write about Johnson's Bluff, Williams Crossing, and Willie Hollow.
They were
all those things.
They were country.
Yeah. And, I was a lieutenant at the time. And I knew a good fellow, he and I were good friends here in Detroit. And he was at Camp McCoy because they had a special unit for the Jewish boys. And I went down to the service club, and he came in, he found out I was there. And while we were there, see, the enlisted men couldn't go in the officers' club, so I went to the service club for where the enlisted men were. And there was a Texan in there. He said, by God, look at that, it's a black lieutenant.
Well, things were all segregated then, though, right?
Yeah, well, they had a segregated unit for the blacks, but the officers could go anywhere.
Really?
And I was a lieutenant.
Well, so,
anyway, the MPs grabbed this kid and was going to throw him in the brig. I told him, wait a minute, don't do that. Just let him alone. His boy's from the South, and he doesn't know any different. He was raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to show my ignorance to because of a little word that he used and me, you know, antagonistic about it. But anyway, they brought those people up here to work in the factories doing the emergency. They could learn to put things together. They didn't have to read and write to do that. They had somebody to show them how to do it and tell them what to do. And they brought their southern customs up here with the blacks and the whites, did the same thing. I know incident, I was with the police department too, incident where a fellow brother came up here and he was taking his brother out, showing him something. And it was on Woodward Avenue, right near Warren Avenue. And when he saw a white person meeting him, he would jump off the sidewalk. And he told him, he said, you don't have to do that. You got just as much right to sidewalk as anyone else. The next morning, he was arrested at 5 o'clock in the morning for knocking people off the sidewalk.
Oh. Well, Samuel, I actually have to move on, but I want to tell you how nice it is to hear from you and get some of those experiences that have happened to you over 108 years. And will you call us again?
Yes, I will.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
I appreciate it. And we checked him out. The man's that old. Wow. Still sounds great. I think maybe with everything that's going on, medical stuff, maybe a lot of us will get to be that old. By the way, Samuel said in passing about Detroit destroying its electric streetcars and buses. In the 1940s and 50s, there were these buses that ran on electric lines and also streetcars. And there was, this has been documented by U.S. congressional testimony, General Motors, Firestone, and who else did he say? Can't remember. But they got together and they figured we got to get combustion engines running gasoline and General Motors vehicles. All right, let's go to Bobby. Bobby's in Detroit. Bobby, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, how you doing there, Pete?
Doing good.
We actually know each other from Joel Landy way back in the day. Well, that's another story altogether. I just pulled over to tell you real quick about the flag situation.
Sure.
It's a law. I got busted in high school for desecrating because I had it sewn upside down here and there, the seat of my pants, back of my jacket, seat of my car, blah, blah, blah. Got arrested in auto shop in high school. They took me down there and they had to let me go because they looked up. Took them a couple hours, but a flag is a given size by law. So anything under that size and reproduced in any other way, shape, or form isn't a flag. It's a image of a flag.
How interesting. Yeah, I was wondering, there was a website when one of these right-wing senators figured they could divert all of our attention from what's really wrong with this country and needs fixing into this stuff about flag desecration, that there was this website with a virtual burning of a flag. So is that flag desecration? I mean, it's so insane. I mean, I understand it enrages people to a degree that if you're not there, you can't understand it. And yet, the Constitution's not the private or not the proper place to allow the people's grievances to take form. That's not what the Constitution's for.
Well, people have too much passion sometimes for the wrong things. They have the right idea, they're just pointing it in the wrong direction. I know what I mean by that.
Sure.
And this is a perfect example of it. You know, this passion is fantastic. We love it, we need it. Just you're not quite adjusted where and what you're doing with it, you know?
Well, the other thing is that there's not a flag-burning problem. It's not, nothing's broke, so why fix it? Why start tinkering with the Constitution with stuff other than what it was meant to be? As I said at the beginning of the show, it was up to the it delineated the responsibility and obligation and the functioning of the governmental apparatus, and it also guarantees certain rights to the people. Why you would put in there stuff about abortion and flag burning and prayer in school is nuts, absolutely nuts. And what it is, these right-wingers are sore losers. They always say, we have great respect for the American system. All right, Congress makes a law, then the Supreme Court has to be the one that decides ultimately whether a law is constitutional or not. The Supreme Court is almost always conservative, so when they make a law, when they judge a law to be unconstitutional, suddenly these guys don't like the American system at all, and they want to change the Constitution. Sore losers, I'd say.
That's a good way of putting it. You had mentioned something earlier, which to those sore loser just sounded even a little bit better. I'm going to let that one go and use that as a great example of the way you like to put things.
All right. Thank you, Bobby. Appreciate your call. Let's go to John. John's in Mount Clemens. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing, Peter? Great show. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
I don't know if you saw, but you're on vacation there last week, but I just wanted to touch on North Korea.
Sure.
And how the White House and the media is trying to whip up everybody in a frenzy about them testing a missile.
Yeah, what's this? All of a sudden, Bush is saying you got to be patient. You got to let. Now here are the they knew that that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, they're gonna say we got to invade them, and did, and all of this has occurred, which has been just such a disaster for everyone involved, for us and for the Iraqis. Now here are these people that actually have weapons of mass destruction and threaten us, and Bush is saying you got to be patient.
Oh, yeah, that's a total right.
What's up with that?
U-turn. My question is, though, is how come we can have all the missiles in the free world enough to destroy this earth 10 times over, and a country that has us sitting on their border for the past 50 years can't test a missile?
Well, yeah, and also, the United States just did missile tests, fired missiles near Korea last month or the month before, had all these military exercises right on North Korea's border. If they want to, look, North Korea had this missile sitting out in the open. It has hundreds of secret sites that are underground and what have you. They put it out there so we would see that. That's pretty clear. What they would like to do is make a deal. One thing that the United States could do would be to sign a peace treaty, or at least broker a peace treaty. I don't know if it was the United States officially at war with North Korea, but have a peace treaty between South Korea and the United States and North Korea, and sign a non-aggression pact. That we would, under no circumstances, unless attacked by them, or if they attack another nation, would we do anything to them? Because most countries are pretty frightened of the United States because they're afraid they're going to get invaded. And one of the ways they know is they cannot be invaded if they do have weapons of mass destruction. Because if you don't have them, like Iraq didn't, you get invaded.
Right. It's like the United States is do as I say, not as we do.
You got it.
And one other quick thing I want to talk about, this governor race with DeVos and Granholm. And a lot of these people, and working-class people, which amazed me, are all saying they're going to vote for DeVos and are blaming Granholm for everything, which I'm not a big Granholm fan, but this DeVos guy, if anybody working a regular 9-to-5 job votes for this guy, they got to be out of their mind.
I'd say you're right, and when you start anybody saying that Jennifer Granholm is responsible for the economic situation in this this state, can anyone say General Motors? Can anyone say
Well, can anyone say that George Bush in the White House? I mean, they don't have the money coming down to state governments like in years past. and in turn the state governments have money for the local governments. We had that situation right here in Mount Clemens where they got rid of their police department after 111 years because they didn't have the money to pay the guys anymore.
Yeah. Well, we've got hundreds of billions to spend on Bush's corrupt friends in Iraq. I got to go, John. Thanks for having joined us, and thanks to all of you for listening and for calling in. We'll talk again next week. Stay tuned for some wonderful interviews.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Boy, I have a book that's extraordinarily interesting, fascinating even, but what a tragedy. Probably one that didn't have to be, and one that brings in, again, the whole question of the drug war, how the Federal Bureau of Investigation operates, and in fact, the role of government in our daily lives. The book is Burning Rainbow Farm, How a Stoner Utopia Went Up in Smoke. And the author is Dean Kuypers. He's the deputy editor of the Los Angeles City Beat and the author of I Am a Bullet, also Ray Gun Out of Control. And his work has appeared in Rolling Stone, the Los Angeles Times, and Playboy. He's from Michigan, Dean Kuypers, who's in Los Angeles now. Welcome back to your home state.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you're not from the Detroit area. You're from Kalamazoo, right?
Yes, I grew up just southwest of Kalamazoo, actually about 20 miles from where this event happened.
All right, well, let's tell, yeah, I talked right over you, which is Rainbow Farm. That was going since about 1993. Tell us about Rainbow Farm, the people that put it together, and what their purpose was in establishing it.
Yeah, it was a Rainbow Farm was a campground and also a concert venue that was put together by a couple fellows, a gay couple named Tom Croslin and Raleigh Rome. Tom had made a bunch of money, not overly much, but had made a small amount in real estate. He was the kind of guy who would fix up old houses and sell them, and he had a full crew of guys who did this for him and with him. And he bought this farm in 93 as a place where they would all go basically as their Shangri-La, and it had an old farmhouse on it. And he turned this place into a major concern. It was a beautiful 54-acre place. He built a nice stage. He built a beautiful camp store. He built, it had a coffee shop and a laundromat. I mean, it turned into a big deal. And beginning in 95, he started getting more into the legalizing of marijuana as his sort of main issue on the farm. He had been into it before then, but he decided to start having actual festivals on the place.
Dean Kuypers, tell us a little more, just situate it for us geographically. You said it was about just pretty close to Kalamazoo. Where exactly? What was the closest town, for instance?
Yeah, Rainbow Farm was in a little village called Vandalia, population 429. About 100 miles east of Chicago, so in the southwest corner of the state.
Okay.
Surprisingly rural area. He was surrounded by all state land there and stuff, so it's pretty remote.
Well, you have this gay couple that's setting up this essentially rock and roll venue. At least that's how it appears to the outsiders in this small town. In fact, I knew people that used to go there for the concerts.
Sure.
And also, they have as their major cause the legalization of marijuana. How did their neighbors relate to all this?
This is why I wanted to do the story, actually, is because this place is sort of a model of rural tolerance. I mean, it shows exactly sort of how we actually do get along in the United States, a lot better than what is actually portrayed in the media. His neighbors liked him. Both these guys. They were responsible people who, took care of their property. Tom was really into improvements, so everything he touched kind of got better. He would do things like drive around in the neighborhoods with his crew and clean up roadside dumps and buy toys for the kids in Vandalia who were impoverished. I mean, he was a good person. And I think he had some beefs with some of the neighbors, because when he would have his festivals, he'd have 5,000 people out there to see Tommy Chong or, quite large crowds from time to time. And that's bound to cause a few problems with a neighbor. But
probably no different than like out at what we used to call Pine Knob, as you may remember it.
And, sure.
Yeah, but now DT Energy Theater. Yeah, that's a lot of people in the neighborhood.
Oh. But but they supported him, and even some people that I talked to who weren't that fond of Tom. I mean, he was an aggressive fellow, kind of a great big burly guy who was sort of rednecky in his own way, and he was used to having his way. And he had a few beefs with a few people, but even the people who didn't like him personally thought what happened to him was wrong,
and
that the government ought to have just left him alone.
And maybe this is a story that is going to take some telling, and well worth the telling, particularly in the book by Dean Kuypers, Burning Rainbow Farm, How a Stoner Utopia Went Up in Smoke. But I don't think we're going to give it away by saying both these men are now dead at the hands of federal agents. But we will continue this story as the program continues. Did the neighbors know they were a gay couple, and was that an issue?
That wasn't an issue at all. As far as I know, most people didn't even know. Tom was quite a bit, he was 20 years older than Raleigh, and a lot of people thought they were father and son. And even the people who knew they were together thought of them as, you know, comrades or co-owners of the property. Most people didn't know that they were a couple. And Raleigh had a son who was 11 years old that he had when he was very young. He was only 15, I think, when Robert was born. So there was all three of them living there. And people thought it was father, son, and grandson, that kind of thing. So that didn't really play in. And once again, I think it's an example of sort of the tolerance of the area, too, that the people that did know thought it was nobody's business. So, you know, these guys were gay, libertarians. They voted for Bush. They had made some money. I mean, that's already a pretty weird combination. But
this is Bush 1 we're talking
about.
Yeah.
And Bush 2 in 2000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that's right. The final events came down in 2001.
Yeah. Well, they voted for both Bushes.
Oh, boy.
But the people they would have on their farm were, you know, Democrats, Greens, Libertarians, Buddhists, Evangelicals. The Michigan Militia had some presence there. I mean, it was a weird and varied mix of people who came out who felt perfectly at home there. And actually all got along there, too, which is pretty exemplary.
Tell me about the quote on the back of your book, Burning Rainbow Farm, where Barbara Ehrenreich, who's the author of an incredible book, Nickel and Dimed, and also a new one, Bait and Switch, she says, Dean Kuypers has given us a deftly reported glimpse into America's blue-collar, rural, stoner subculture. Is that actually a definable group of people?
Sure. Yeah, I think it is. And I didn't really know that was until I went back and started doing some research about this place. But there's a lot of folks, for instance, Tom and Raleigh were originally from Elkhart, which is just across the border from Rainbow Farm. And a lot of the folks that would come up there worked in the factories of Elkhart. And most of the people who came there were blue-collar folks. I mean, they worked for the phone company or they were farmers, proud people with families who are making a living doing blue-collar work. And they came out of the woodwork there, strangely, of all the political things that are going on in the world, the thing that really got them out was the intrusive nature of the drug war. And they wanted the law enforcement off their back. They want to reduce these mandatory minimum penalties. They want to reduce urine testing in the factories. They want to stop the local law enforcement from busting regular potheads, which they are doing, you know, with more and more frequency throughout the country. And like I said, strangely, that's the issue that really got their blood up and got these sort of reticent rural dwellers out in public to protest.
Was there a lot of marijuana being grown out in that area? I know it's in many places. It's a very, very lucrative agricultural crop.
Yeah, you know what? It's the amount that's grown actually is not that much in Michigan. Michigan's not one of the primary growing states, despite what we might think there. Not like, you know, a Kentucky or something like that, where it's one of the number one cash crops in the entire state. There was a lot of people out at Rainbow Farm that were smoking weed. That was the point of the place, is that you would come out and sort of do your misdemeanor protest. If they were busting, that was a misdemeanor, and be out there smoking weed in defiance of the laws that exist. But on Rainbow Farm, it was a policy, and in the surrounding area and amongst the staff, not to grow and not to be involved with growing or sales of any kind, because, of course, that was a felony that would bring the whole place down, and they knew that.
Dean Kuypers, you mentioned before about rock concerts out there, and you mentioned the presence of Tommy Chong, and I was just searching my brain. I was trying to remember, there were other, not top acts, but a number of other well-known acts, I think, played out there, if my memory is correct.
Sure, yeah. Well, the biggest one they ever had is Merle Haggard, which was not one of their hemp festivals, but was a one-off concert they were doing just to kind of, because they would do concerts as well that weren't involved with hemp festivals. But during their festivals, they had a lot of jam bands, a lot of folks like Leftover Salmon, who are quite popular, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Mike Clark's Birds Celebration, which is kind of an assemblage of various folks that were in the Birds at different times. Stuff like that, you know, where recognizable names.
Now, wait, I should tell people that I think most people, hopefully they remember, it was Janis Joplin was in Big Brother. She was the singer for Big Brother in the Holding Company, and Jim Gurley, the lead guitar, was from the Detroit area, and said, gee, I should have gone out there.
Yeah, indeed. I wish that I would have gone out
yeah,
there.
But well, this happened. Dean Kuipers, what turned you on to this story? Here, you've left Kalamazoo, Michigan, and you're out in Los Angeles with a jillion stories of its own, ones you cover as deputy editor of the Los Angeles City Beat. How did you get turned on to rural Michigan and what happened there?
Well, I mean, Michigan is where I'm from, and I love any opportunity actually to write about the community out there. And when I say the community, I mean specifically this rural community that was near Rainbow Farm, because that's where I grew up. And I think that these kind of things are always misrepresented in the press. We tend to look at things as being, you know, red state, blue state, godless or, you know, God-fearing, that kind of thing. And that's not how it is at all. And the folks out in the rural parts of the country are varied and interesting and represent all kinds of different points of views that basically all decide to get along as neighbors. Maybe, you know, it helps that they're separated by some geography, but that really put the hook in me, because Rainbow Farm was a place where they would all gather. All mm-hmm. the neighbors went there. And I found out about the story by reading it off the cover of the Kalamazoo Gazette.
Really?
I used to get a subscription to my home in Venice, and it showed up there about a week after, or about 4 or 5 days after 9/11 happened. This crazy story was on the front page. And I was immediately hooked. It was right there in the title of the story. It was "It Just Doesn't Make Sense," which was a quote from someone, and it didn't. I mean, these were two guys that didn't seem like they should be killed and or be in some kind of armed standoff with the police, and there they were.
All right, you are starting to go exactly where I was going to suggest, because I know sometimes people don't have the opportunity to listen to the entirety of the show. So right now they're sitting in their car. And they want to know, what the hell happened? The book is Burning Rainbow Farm, How a Stoner Utopia Went Up in Smoke. It's published by Bloomsbury. And my guest is Dean Kuipers, who has written the book. So there's this farm. They support marijuana. And then I'll the little piece that I know of. They were busted. The two owners, Tom Crossland and Raleigh Rome, his partner, were busted for growing marijuana in their house. Am I correct?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, your listeners should pull over now in the driveway or somewhere, because this is the good part, or the bad part, as the case may be. That was always one of the rules at Rainbow Farm, was that you couldn't grow pot, you couldn't sell pot. Well, they broke their own rule, and in 2001, during the winter, they built a grow room in their basement, and nobody knew about it. I guess there was maybe one or two farmhands there who knew about it, but they kept it very secret, and it was not for sale. I guess it was going to be for their own use, and they got busted. The prosecutor came in on the old Elliot Ness routine and got him on taxes. He came in with a tax warrant. They seemed to know that there was pot there. They went right to the basement, got the pot, got a drug warrant, and busted him. That was the start of their troubles. The prosecutor had been threatening them for years that he would take the farm through forfeiture, and their real standoff with one another before it became an armed standoff was over this forfeiture provision, which means he could take their farm. He didn't have a felony to do that, and suddenly in this May of 2001, he did have a felony, and so he filed for forfeiture immediately that same day. And Tom and Raleigh got bailed out of jail, and about a week later, the day Tom got out of jail, I think, Raleigh's son Robert didn't come home from school. Sheriffs had picked him up in the school and put him in foster care. And the rationale that was given to me was that it was because they can do that if the parents smoke pot, and they said they found a couple shotguns in the house, and Tom wasn't supposed to have those. He was a felon from much earlier in his life, in his 20s, and he wasn't supposed to have guns, and so they said with the guns that was enough, and they took the child away, and they put him in foster care, and Tom never did see him again, ever. And Raleigh started going through the motions that he needed to go through to get his son back. It seemed somewhat hopeful, but Tom was on a downhill slide at that point. He was upset that they were going to take his farm. He was upset that he was going to go to jail for a long time under mandatory minimums. And basically, he had lost this battle, and the prosecutor was pushing forward. And on August 31st of that year, they had their first court date, and they didn't show up. And instead, Tom and Raleigh and perhaps one other farmhand who stayed behind, a guy named Jim, burned the farm to the ground.
Really?
And it was, you know, like I said, it was quite a deluxe place, and it was worth a lot of money, and a store, and a coffee shop, and a laundromat, bunch of stuff.
They wanted to make sure that if it was forfeited, that no one was going to profit from it.
Exactly. Yeah, they were. That's what happens with forfeited stuff: is they auction it off, and the police get the money. Tom was not going to let that happen, so he burned the place, everything except the farmhouse. Then it was a standoff. The sheriff knew better than to go back there because he knew Tom was a bit of a hothead, and he had been warned that they had guns. Tom had managed to get himself a couple assault rifles and was sitting out there basically just waiting for whatever was going to happen. It's a pretty remote place, so they were about 3/4 of a mile from any neighbor, so it was pretty safe to just leave them out there. But sometime during that first day, a news helicopter flew over from WNDU in South Bend, and a TV helicopter, and someone at the farm shot at it. That's an FAA violation that brought in the feds, so by the next morning, September 1st, it was a FBI investigation. And they weren't going to stand on the perimeter and just let it devolve. They actually started putting in sniper observer teams into the trees, around the house, kind of getting closer and closer to the house surreptitiously. And on September 3rd, Tom Croslin was walking to the neighbor's house to get some coffee. He was a guy that he got along with good, and he ran out of coffee. So he was coming back with a coffee pot, and he ran across the three agents in the woods who must have rustled the branches or something, and one of them stepped out from behind a tree and shot him in the head.
Hmm. Now, they say that Tom pointed the gun at him.
Yes, that's right. They say he was going into a posture, you know, a shooting position. We don't know because there was a witness, but he's not talking. A young boy, an 18-year-old neighbor, had walked into Rainbow Farm in the middle of the whole thing, barefoot, just a kid who lived next door and who knew Tom and Raleigh a little bit and thought that he could help somehow. He thought he could talk them out, basically. And he wasn't going out there to join them. He was going out there to ask them to give themselves up because he didn't want to see them get killed. And so he was walking with Tom. He was actually carrying the coffee pot and was walking in Tom's footprints because Tom told him that the woods were mined,
wow.
which they weren't. But he was telling him that to keep people out of there. And the kid was walking right behind him and got splattered. And he says that he can't talk. Because if he talks, they've evidently threatened him with a prosecution as an accessory. So he's never talked to anybody. Although I did read some FBI debriefings of him. So.
Did you talk to him or try to talk to him?
Yeah, I tried, and I talked to everyone around him. I talked to his ex-girlfriend. I talked to his mom. I talked to his friends. I talked to everybody but him. But he just politely declined.
All right, so it's September 2001. Tom Croslin has been killed by three FBI agents on Rainbow Farm, and
yes.
Now that leaves Raleigh Rome, his partner.
Yes, Raleigh was the only one left at that point. There had been another fellow there named Jim. He had managed to walk out of the farm and got arrested on some other charge. So it was just Raleigh, poor Raleigh, who was more of a follower. He was definitely not the aggressive one of the two. And a very heavy smoker, and I think that he was pretty confused at the time. He seemed to have been. He agreed that he was actually going to, he accepted a phone finally and agreed that he would give himself up the next morning at 7 a.m. if they would bring his son out there. So the son, Robert, was in the car traveling out there at about 6 a.m. and suddenly the house was on fire, and Raleigh, they say, you know, Raleigh set the house on fire. A lot of people dispute that. And Raleigh was running around in the backyard with the dog, seemed to be a little bit confused. He was putting the gun down at various times in the grass and, you know, holding the dog and that kind of thing. And Michigan State Police troopers pulled up in an armored vehicle. And as they did so, I guess he went into some kind of crouching position, and a Michigan State Police sniper in the tree line shot him and killed him. So he never did squeeze off a shot either. They say that he was going into a shooting position, but once again, we don't really have a witness other than police, and that's their story, and they're sticking to it.
Well, Dean Kuypers, there certainly appears, both from your telling and in your incredible book, Burning Rainbow Farm, How a Stoner Utopia Went Up in Smoke, sympathy for the two of them. Yet they certainly made error after error after error. Had they not, they would probably still be alive today. Who knows? They might, well, if they hadn't grown the marijuana, they would they might even still have the farm. How do we sort that out? I mean, on one hand, it's certainly a tragedy. On the other hand, they many ways, or maybe completely, set the context for the destruction of their farm and the end of their lives.
Sure. Well, Tom, sure, they made a lot of mistakes. Tom was an absolutist on the idea, on the position of rights, on his property rights, on his rights as a person who should be able to use marijuana. He was a guy who just wouldn't accept a compromise, and that definitely set the stage. I mean, when he said, if he would have gone through with the prosecution, he would probably still be in jail, but Raleigh would probably be out by now, because he didn't have as heavy charges as Tom. He'd probably be out and living somewhere in the area and have his son, and everything might be okay for him. But Tom was the kind of guy who just wasn't going to back down. He would rather play something out to the end, and he did play it all the way out. Growing the marijuana was a very foolish thing to do. They were two of the best-known pot activists in the state at that point. Picking up guns pretty much sealed his fate, I think. When you know you've got a prosecutor who's after you, and you're definitely in trouble with the law. Picking up a gun is almost certain to cause a lot more trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So sure, it's mixed, but what I try to demonstrate through the book is that that maybe we ought to take another look at this forfeiture law. That was a big threat to Tom, and the idea that they could take all of his property for him growing some plants of marijuana in his basement really rubbed him the wrong way. He thought it was an outrage. And I think that there's lots of people in this country that would agree with him.
I think so. And also it asks that we look at the marijuana laws themselves, because I'm not quite sure what they're there for. I guess to protect us from bad health. Or, I mean, that's the only, what else? I mean, that's the...
Well, they tell us to, they tell me two things. They tell me that it's a bad message for the kids.
What's a bad message?
Well, to let marijuana be legal, you know, they still stick to this ridiculous gateway drug theory that if, you know, you let kids smoke weed, then the next thing that happens is they're hooked on heroin.
Well, yeah, they want to protect, however you cut it, they want to protect our health. So
right.
In order to do that, they've put millions of people in jail, forfeited thousands of pieces of property, killed I don't know how many people, wasted tens of millions, maybe billions of, probably billions of dollars on a drug war that is completely unsuccessful. Maybe they should, not protect us so much.
Well, or, you know, maybe they should start to look at some of the science, too, because there's a medical marijuana issue here. And it's been pretty well established that the people who really want to use marijuana, and a lot of those people were at Rainbow Farm where this happened, are people who are patients of MS, who have MS, or who have other illnesses that give them seizures or different kinds of spasticity, who have glaucoma, or who are cancer patients who are in chemo, or are AIDS patients who need something to keep their appetite up. The government keeps poo-pooing these things as being like, yeah, that's just an excuse to get high. And the people who take that stuff medicinally are furious about this, because they can use marijuana to do these things in a cheap and responsible way that they can titrate themselves without having to go through some gigantic pharmaceutical company to get their stuff at a super high expense.
Well, I guess I'm as libertarian as Tom Croslin and Raleigh Rome. I don't think it's any of the government's business what I want to use an intoxicating substance for, as long as I do it responsibly, don't drive, don't do anything that would endanger anyone else. If it's my health that I'm jeopardizing, so be it. It's my business, not guys with guns.
Well, and I'm sure that the people at Rainbow Farm would have agreed with you 100%. That was their stance.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me. My guest has been Dean Kuypers. The book, an incredible read, absolutely must reading. Burning Rainbow Farm, How a Stoner Utopia Went Up in Smoke, and it's published by Bloomsbury. Dean Kuypers, thanks for joining us on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you so much, Peter. I enjoyed it.
WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's always on my mind every day when I look at the paper, just what a violence-filled world this is. Even if you only passingly look at the television, let alone immerse yourself as I torture myself with, it's pretty easy to realize. There's a lot of violence, a lot of bloodshed, a lot of wars, a lot of civil wars, just a world that seems drenched in blood. The 20th century, the bloodiest century in human history. We haven't done quite as badly yet, but we're just getting started. And it's pretty easy to say. Sometimes I even think that myself, that wars like this are inevitable. People have conflicts. Groups fight groups. Religions fight religions. Nation states fight nation states. But is war inevitable? Right now I'm reading off the back of a book. Must it be that people are always fighting and terrorizing one another? Joining me is Mary Wynne Ashford, who, along with Guy Dauncey, has written Enough Bloodshed, 101 Solutions to Violence, Terror, and War. And joining me from British Columbia is Mary Wynne Ashford. Mary Wynne, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, in my most cynical, in fact, I don't even know it's my most cynical, but very frequently in a cynical mood, I think, if we can look through history and what we've seen, it does look like war is inevitable, and yet you and Guy Dauncey, who's been on this show before, are proposing 101 solutions to violence, terror, and war. And I should say that you've been the past president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and that won a 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. So you've been doing this for a while. I'm getting discouraged. You're not?
Oh, Peter, I have periods of terrible discouragement, especially because I spend so much of my life talking about nuclear weapons and the need to get rid of them, and in doing that, I plunge into my own fear. But the thing that has changed me is writing this book, where I actually promised that I would find successful interventions that have really worked all around the world to reduce violence and armed conflict and to end wars or to prevent wars. And I must say, I was a bit anxious. I thought I could probably find 50 of these examples, but would I find 101? I wasn't sure. And in the end, I found thousands, and I'm not exaggerating. I found examples of people in remote areas, like in the Philippines, for example, where they had come up with creative ways to avoid armed conflict. And I found major ones, of course, like Gandhi being able to overturn the British Empire's hold on India. And throughout, I kept thinking, I can't believe this. This is going on everywhere. And yet, if I watch television or listen to the news, I get the feeling that the world is spinning downhill. And it turns out that it's not. It turns out that we are turning away from war all over the world.
Well, 99% of people, I'm sure, want peace and probably work for it, and could very well be, without these examples that I'm going to ask you to give us, there could be a lot more wars. When you say you found, was this through research, in other words, like reading in the Internet, or did you see any of this firsthand?
Some of it I knew from my experiences working in the peace movement. For example, meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev and talking about the threat of nuclear war and seeing how that actually changed his view and moved him toward starting the process of nuclear disarmament. That kind of experience that I've had has affected me very deeply. But in addition, just reading other people's stories and then starting to research what is going on in Israel with the Israelis and Palestinians, for example. And then I discovered that there are more than 1,000 organizations that include both Israelis and Palestinians, all working toward a peaceful resolution. Well, I find that hugely hopeful in spite of what's happening there right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just give you my one big objection, and then we'll get into
sure.
your 101 solutions. Mary Wynne Ashford is my guest. She's a co-author of Enough Bloodshed, 101 Solutions to Violence, Terror, and War. Is that 1%, I said 99% of us want peace, the 1% who are quite mad usually wind up being our politicians. Yeah, that's...
You know, that is exactly the problem that we face as global civil society, is that These wars and the animosities that lead up to them are led by a very small number of, usually men, but not always, who are using war to their own advantage. And we in civil society simply have to stop that from happening. And we now know that civil society is the strongest it's ever been in history. We have an impact at the United Nations. We have an impact on our own governments that is simply unprecedented. And I like to think of a healthy society as having three pillars. The first one is government, and that has to be clean and honest and so on, and representative. Second pillar is the economy, and the third pillar is civil society, which is the conscience that restrains the other two. And that's the part that is stronger now than ever in history.
Mm-hmm. Well, the ability, though, particularly with modern means of communication for these people I'm identifying as being quite mad, this 1%, have the ability to jerk us around, so to play on our fears, particularly our fears, but also our anger in the case of 9/11. And without you quite correctly speak about civil society, but it still is not coherent enough, not autonomous enough, not independent enough, usually, in order to stand up to this, you know, the mass media, for instance, is being manipulated by politicians that have decided way in advance to go to war.
You're absolutely right. I'm certainly not saying that everything's rosy from here on in. We're at the beginning of a huge revolution, and by golly, it's a tough road ahead for us. But what I am seeing is that revolution is happening everywhere, and in the United States and Canada, we're seeing it gaining strength. In terms of the media, there are now many actions toward independent media that would be funded by private subscriptions rather than by advertising or by government sponsoring or censoring it, as the case may be. We're seeing such things as The Real News is one of the independent television stations that's supposed to open in January, I think, of 2007. And this is only one of many different examples of media that are independent because they can function through the web rather than through very expensive production studios. So from that point, I think we will see the voice of ordinary people becoming much more available to everyone.
Tell us a little about the foreword. I just noticed that by Arun Gandhi. Is that a relationship to the Gandhi?
Yes, he's Gandhi's grandson, and he's a very, very fine man who is speaking all over the world about nonviolent interventions, and particularly about how they're rooted in our spiritual understanding of ourselves and of the world. But he has been speaking in Israel to both Palestinians and Israelis and moving them to joint projects that are really very exciting, and it was extraordinarily kind of him to write this forward for me.
One of the things that seems to me that we have to tackle is this sense of always, each side sees itself as the victims. I mean, the Nazis insisted that they were victims of the Jews, and they were fighting back, that each side is the one with the grievance, the other side are the evil, the bad guys. So, I mean, all this absurd rhetoric that's crept into our political discourse. How do we stop those separations on one hand, and on the other hand, what do we do with those people that actually are doing bad and awful things to us and other people?
Well, right.
Two questions, really. Sorry.
Two questions. Well, on the first one about rhetoric, I think we have to listen. And what we're seeing in schools now is that children are being taught how to listen and how to communicate clearly without the blaming and the down-putting of the other person. So in another 10 or 15 years, we'll see the impact of that in the adult population. For now, I would say that many, many community groups are learning about nonviolent communication. You have a person in the U.S., Marshall Rosenberg, who's very famous for his teachings in this line. And that's at the basis of these organizations that work across enemy lines. And in Sri Lanka, for example, between the Sinhalese and the Tamils, or in the Koreas, in both North and South Korea, you have people working in this way. It is a learned skill. Believe me, I know how difficult it is to listen to someone saying something outrageous and making threats and being completely unreasonable. And yet, you have to persevere. You have to continue to listen. You have to move forward where you have common ground. We know more about this now than we ever have, because the whole study of conflict resolution has advanced so much just in the past 10 or 15 years. And now I forget the second question.
Me too.
I know. How do we protect ourselves against absolutely evil?
Yeah.
And right. And I'm referring to terrorists or people who use suicide bombing or people who are blowing up houses or buildings or what have you. These actions are actions that require a police force, not a military. And we have the ability to locate the perpetrators. We have the ability to prevent many, many of these. And it does require a very active citizenry. It requires that ordinary people pay attention to circumstances that are very suspicious and report them if that seems warranted. But it does not require a military response. Bombing a town or a city is not a good answer to preventing terrorism. Police action and building stronger communities is certainly an answer. And building stronger communities is a big project, and it works in the same way as preventing gang violence. It means reconnecting people with their communities and with their friends and with the earth as well.
And it also means going, I'm sure you would agree, going a long way towards solving grievances that people have, the differences in wealth across the world, solving many of the economic and medical and social problems that breed what we then call inevitable results, which are war. It's always about the root cause. People often ask me, well, what's your solution to the immigration problem? I say, I don't have any, other than trying to make a situation where people don't feel they have to cross the borders in order to have a good life.
We have to deal with injustices, and we have to recognize that if the other person feels that there's an enormous injustice, we have to listen. And we have to then say, well, what can we do now in the face of all of this? We can't continue to exploit people, and no country can continue to exploit a minority population. We have to have ways to make sure that all people have an opportunity to, well, first of all, for basic survival, but beyond that, that they have an opportunity to make a decent living and provide a decent life for their children.
The book is Enough Bloodshed, 101 Solutions to Violence, Terror, and War, and we will get to some of the individual ones. My guest and the author, Mary Wynne Ashford, has written the book with Guy Dauncey, and it's published by New Society Publishers. You can go to newsociety.com, see this book and lots of other ones that are very important as well. Mary Wynne, you live in Victoria, British Columbia, and the United States is seen as the big military power. Canada always very, very peaceful, at least in our view, and both in popular culture and maybe actually. I know on a talk show that I've done, I suggested to some Canadian listeners, because we're right on the Detroit-Windsor, you know, we're sister cities, that Canada disband its army. I said there's only one possible country that could ever invade Canada, and that's the United States, and they couldn't stop it anyway. So they might as well do like Costa Rica does, and just because the important thing is, and people say, oh, our army, but that takes so much money, and here you have this admirable medical, this government medical program, so people don't face the situation like they do here in the United States. But there's not enough money to fund it adequately, and here we have the new prime minister. Now, Detroit listeners, you know who the prime minister of Canada is, right? Well, you have, you know, the Canada's own George Bush, Stephen Harper, who has now said he's going to expand the military and expand military spending.
Yes, and spending has now gone up to $20 billion a year, up from 11 and then $15 billion, and now it's $20
billion. Let me just say quickly, the United States loses that much money in Iraq without having any idea what even happened to it, really. Well,
no, that's true.
It disappears, but go ahead.
And I should not be laughing.
This is horrible. This is,
and yeah. I do agree with the idea that Canada could do away with having an offensive military. I think Canada has a huge role to play as peacekeeping in the peacekeeping field and in the peace building, which is reconstruction after a war. We have expertise in that area, and we're highly respected in the world for that. That is what we should be doing. And if I talk about Afghanistan, Canada currently has a combat role assisting the United States in Afghanistan. We would be far better to be doing our peacekeeping role instead and working in helping to rebuild that country from the point of view of democracy and education and social services. And I think that Canada could take that role. There is a large constituency in Canada that would support us doing that and letting the combat role go completely.
Well, we'll leave that to our Canadian listeners to get a hold of me. Let's go right into the book, Enough Bloodshed, 101 Solutions. How did you select the solutions? Because there's a tremendous variation in what they are. I mean, everything from say it with music to remember your humanity to expand nuclear weapon-free zones. I mean, that's all over the board, which I suppose is good because we want to take in all of human activity and culture.
What we wanted to do was give examples of, I shouldn't call them solutions. They're really steps forward and perhaps transient steps, and we know that there'll be half a step backward and so on. So solutions may be a bit arrogant, but nonetheless, that's the title. And what they are is examples that are tailored to give ideas to people at various different stages in their lives and different kinds of work that they might want to do. So we have solutions for individuals, for women, children, educators, nations in conflict, media, business and labor, cities, and so on. And within those clusters, I give examples from many different countries, many of them from North America, of course, and then give suggestions of people who are picking up some really creative ideas and trying them, and those ideas seem to be working. So I've included them, plus the resources where you can find more information.
Well, I frequently talk to people who say to me, well, I agree with everything you say, but what do I do? What do I do next? And
yeah.
A lot of people they want to wait in the States here till November to vote. Which, okay, I always say that's number 134th in your list of things to do, that there's a lot of other things to do.
Before then.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
and
for sure.
And I'm sure you've heard that as well. What is typically your response? Or you just give them your book?
Oh, no, I don't. I tell them they can take it out of the library. I do want them to read it and get some ideas. What I suggest, the major and most effective thing to do is to go and meet face-to-face with your elected member of parliament or member of your Congress and tell them how you feel. If you can't do that, you either write a letter or you phone their office and give your feelings on a particular issue. Now, those are the most common things that people do. And, of course, people march. But those are the things that we've been doing for years, and people say, well, I've done that. What right. else can I do? And that's why I say, as you said, say it with music. We can work for peace through whatever it is that we do in our spare time, the thing that we love. We can write music or poetry. We can paint art that tells how we might get out of some of these conflict situations. We can teach children how to interact nonviolently. We can look at journalism for peace. And this is actually one of my favorite things that's happening in the world, is that in many conflict zones, like the Balkans, where we've already had a war, or like Rwanda, or even in Sierra Leone in Africa, there are radio stations and television stations that are presenting soap operas that bring together both sides. So, you know, the soap opera is always based on the young couple falling in love, and that's the wrong person, the wrong time, and so on. And it grips us with the drama, but the drama is around people falling in love across a conflict zone, and how do we deal with problems like HIV/AIDS or child soldiers and so on, all built into popular entertainment. These are absolutely brilliant programs. There's some in Afghanistan, in fact, where they're training young Afghan women to run radio talk shows where other women can phone in with health issues and problems in their community. Terribly dangerous work for the woman who is the interviewer, and yet these women are completely committed to opening up their society and educating women and bringing them into the mainstream of society.
You know, we were on to the solutions in your book, Enough Bloodshed, Mary Wynne Ashford, but something just popped into my mind, an email I got the other day from some guy, a listener that was outraged by what I was saying, and he said that this is a world in which it's either kill or be killed, and if it was up to people like me, he said, that the Taliban would still be in power in Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein would still be in power in Iraq, and that we would still be threatened by the terrorist who had struck on September 11th. The idea being is that these ideas we have are, quote, nice, and I'm identifying with your ideas,
sure.
But ultimately they're not very practical because nice guys finish last,
sure.
and it is about guys. Essentially.
And we mostly heard this, and perhaps still hear it, from people who were in Eastern Europe and had been dominated by the Russians. And, you know, they're speaking from a lot of their own personal history. But what I raise with them now is the fact that 60, that is 60, dictators have been toppled nonviolently since 1986. I mean, that's a dramatic number of success stories of people who rose up and said, we refuse to have this military oppression any longer, and they stood their ground. A few of them died, not a large number, and they managed to overturn these dictators. We know the lessons from that. We know how that happens and how to encourage it. And I know that there are American foundations that are certainly helping with this in some countries, such as the Ukraine. It's not the final answer, because once you overturn the dictator, then the country still has to go on and develop a democracy that actually works. So it's not as if getting rid of the dictator solves all of your problems forever. But what I'm saying is, to bring about regime change, that's a far preferable way than bombing from 30,000 feet.
Or if you're entirely selfish, losing or having 20,000 casualties like the United States has in Iraq, we're in a situation, people don't talk about this much, whereas Saddam Hussein probably would not have lasted in power had the United States not invaded. That is, that it was suddenly shown that he had an army of dust, he had no weapons of mass destruction, and he was having UN inspectors forced into his country. A lot of observers think this could have led easily to his downfall. The regime was very fragile. But we only have a minute or so left, so we should try to come to a conclusion. Is there any one of these 101, what you list as solutions, that if we were going to leave after this broadcast, that you would say take that, or does it in many ways depend on the person and their personality?
It does depend on the person, and yet I'm an educator as well as a medical doctor, and I really think that what we're doing now in schools is probably the most important thing that we can do, and that is to teach young people that there are always alternatives to violence, that we can always find a different solution to conflict in our own lives and conflict in our cities and communities. And in the book, I mentioned the example of a school in India. It's a city Montessori school that's in Lucknow, India, where they've been going since 1959. They've had 250,000 people go through all of their different campuses. And the result is that when there was violence all over India as a result of an extremist action that brought Hindus against Muslims, In Lucknow, there was hardly any violence at all, and they credit that. They credit the Montessori teachings and the Gandhian lessons that those children learned with preventing their city from breaking down into violence.
And civil society, us, the people, the non-politicians, really have to gain a self-confidence. We've been referred to as the second superpower, and don't you think that we have to begin acting like that?
You know, we have to go beyond thinking of ourselves as protesters pounding at the gate where nobody listens to us, and instead see ourselves as the third pillar, the conscience, that has to restrain government and business. And when we think of ourselves as the third pillar, we have a completely different attitude.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. My guest has been Mary Wynne Ashford with Guy Dauncey. She's written Enough Bloodshed, 101 Solutions to Violence, Terror, and War. It has an introduction, a foreword by Aaron Gandhi, who is the grandson of the great Gandhi. And it's published by New Society Publishers. You can go to newsociety.com. Mary Wynne Ashford, thanks for joining me on The Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson, I love you.
Hello, Jay Hudson.
You're listening to Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
What's up, Motor City?
I need to hear that, man.
One badass mother.
There is none higher.
Mr. Jay Hudson.
You're my boy!
Party with Jay Hudson.
Oh, that sounds so sweet.
I'm calling the shots!
Oh,
this is a nightmare.
Yow!
You're rocking out with Jay Hudson.
Well, la-dee-frickin-da!
Rip rocks.